opinion. I will be back next Sunday, 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. But in the meantime, if you've missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on both Global Player and the LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1, it's Richard Spur, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. Angela Rayner has bought a home, which has upset some people a very great deal. We'll talk about why that might be. Alarming numbers of people are falling victim to online scams. We'll hear from our technology correspondent on what to look out for. We'll hear the latest about the wars in Gaza and Ukraine and check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there and talk about the plan for the distribution of the winter fuel allowances. But first, Keir Starmer reacts to the protests on asylum seekers being housed in hotels by speeding up the processing of their claims. But is that going to satisfy the mob? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Conservatives are accusing the government of not going far enough with its promise to speed up the appeals process for asylum seekers. Ministers want to see judges taken out of the equation and replaced by adjudication panels. They're hoping that would shorten the wait for a decision from around a year. LBC's Laura Makin-Isherwood says the government is looking to halve the wait time.
The Home Secretary says she wants to introduce a 24-week limit on decisions being made for those people too. Yvette Cooper saying we cannot carry on with these completely unacceptable delays in appeals as a result of a system that she says she's inherited, which mean that failed asylum seekers stay in the system for years on end at a huge cost to the taxpayer.
A man's been hit in the face with a petrol bomb while reportedly putting up flags in Hertfordshire. Police in Stevenage say he was hit by a glass bottle containing a lit rag on Saturday, as LBC's Joe Hawkins now reports.
It's believed the injured man is in his 30s and suffered a cut to the head after being hurt on Saturday lunchtime. Hertfordshire police say he was then taken to Lister Hospital in Stevenage for treatment. Online, a group calling itself Stevenage Patriots has said on X it was hanging St George's flags on lampposts and poles for around 3 hours when the attack happened. Police say they're investigating a contained incident and are now trying to reassure the local community.
Figures out in the last hour say 140 people have been arrested at and around the Notting Hill Carnival in West London. The Met says 35 were detained on approaches to the event as a result of proactive policing. Four of the arrests were on the suspicion of sexual offences. Volodymyr Zelensky has been using Ukraine's Independence Day to promise to continue fighting Russian aggression. He's also been thanking the king, who's praised the unbreakable courage and spirit of the Ukrainian people, 34 years since it left the old Soviet Union. The Kremlin's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has denied accusations Russia is trying to stall a meeting between Ukraine's leader and President Putin.
There is no meeting planned, and I'm not challenging this. Putin is ready to meet with Zelensky. When the agenda would be ready for a summit. And this agenda is not ready at all.
And in sport, Britain's Emma Raducanu has eased into the second round of the US Open tennis tournament. She's knocked out the Japanese player Ena Shibahara. LBC weather, largely dry with variable cloud overnight. Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland could experience some drizzle. We'll see a low in some places of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. As a second day of demonstrations outside asylum hotels saw protesters clash with police, the Home Office has announced that it will overhaul the asylum appeal system to try to clear the claims backlog. The government set out plans to accelerate the appeals process for refugees whose claims are rejected, with Yvette Cooper introducing the new system of professional adjudicators to hear appeals by rejected asylum seekers. The Home Secretary said the fast-track system would see decisions made more quickly to help Labour meet its promise to end the use of asylum hotels. The proposals have been worked on for months, but are being accelerated because of the recent High Court legal ruling on the hotel in Epping. I am joined now to talk about this by human rights lawyer Shoaib Khan. Good evening, Shoaib. Good evening, Shoaib.
Good evening.
Ah, there you are. So, as far as you're aware, what is this new plan on processing claims?
Yes. Well, we don't have much details now, and to be honest, a lot of it is a bit confusing, I think, for anyone who's worked in the system. Because what they are suggesting is that they won't be called immigration judges anymore, they won't be courts, it will be a tribunal system with immigration adjudicators. Now, so far as we can see, they're saying there'll be professional adjudicators, but I'm assuming that would be someone with legal knowledge or experience of the immigration and asylum system. So really, that is what we already have in a way. I know they're called judges for now, but they are basically immigration lawyers, solicitors, barristers, academics, NGO workers, people who have worked in the sector, who then adjudicate these claims. And in fact, a few decades ago, when this was first set up, they were in fact called immigration adjudicators. Eventually, their title became judge. So I'm not really sure what the difference is going to be. And also what we see for now in the first tier tribunal, which these panels are supposed to replace, and we usually have one immigration judge hearing a case. Now we're hearing some reports suggest it might be a panel of adjudicators. So in fact, what that means is we would need more adjudicators than there are at the moment. So I'm not really sure how it's really going to be speeding things up.
And is there an available pool of experts to call on to man or person, would be a more politically correct way of putting it, to person these adjudicating panels?
Yes, that's the thing. Like I said, I mean, what comes to mind when you say, they're going to be professional adjudicators or experts. So experts would, what seems to me, experts on immigration or asylum are going to be lawyers or academics or NGO, other people who have worked in the field. And those are basically either people who are advising these immigrants or asylum seekers at the moment, or indeed then go on to become judges. So I really, even, despite going through the details, I can't really see what difference is going to make or who these people are going to be. Unless what they are suggesting somehow, which I really hope they're not, is people who have no experience of the system. And they're going to be sort of civil servants or, some other class of people with no experience of the immigration or asylum system. I'm not really sure where this, new pool to set up panels are suddenly going to come from.
The government says that it would, the aim is to halve the time it takes to review people's claims from a year to 6 months. That still sounds like a very long time.
That is a very long time, and that's the thing. I mean, I know the Home Office, the government, other people, the media seem to suggest that somehow either the asylum seeker's fault or somehow it works in their favour. But in fact, what we see is obviously it's people's lives brought to a standstill, really for months on end, for years. And obviously, if they want to reduce the backlog, there's so many other ways of doing that. Firstly, what they need to do is just improve Home Office decision-making so that fewer cases actually go to appeal. Almost half, usually it's between 50 to 60% every year, of immigration asylum appeals are allowed. It basically means at least half of the decisions the Home Office is making are wrong. So if they just got the decision wrong in the right in the first place, then so many cases wouldn't go to appeal. So I think that's an obvious way of reducing this. But secondly, some of the other things that they're suggesting. So for instance, they said they would prioritize the claims brought by people who are in public-funded accommodations. So asylum seekers in hotels or other state-provided accommodation would be prioritized. But what that basically means, to my mind, is then all asylum seekers would potentially say they're homeless and they can't afford a home. So they'd be struggling, they'd be fighting to get into hotels just so the cases would be prioritized, which to me makes no sense. That's really defying the purpose, isn't it? So for now, if we have half the people in private accommodation paying their own rent and half the people in hotels, so if the hotel people are then prioritized, obviously everyone will want to get a space in a hotel, which I don't really see how it's going to serve any purpose or bring down the backlog.
If the government does speed up the asylum process, is it likely, as you've hinted at, to lead to bad decisions? And if so, what effect will The government's suggestion that they will prevent judges from hearing appeals have.
Yes, so I mean, obviously, my first point was about the initial asylum decision itself before the case comes to these appeals. So basically, the adjudicators they're proposing are that a Home Office caseworker would first make a decision. In case someone is refused asylum, they can then appeal or ask these adjudicators to review their decision. So obviously, the first thing is that we need to train the Home Office caseworkers to make the right decision in the first place, firstly. But secondly, yes, I mean, you know, from your point, that's the thing. If we're going to remove judges and potentially, like I said, you know, already immigration solicitors, barristers, immigration experts and academics are the people who become judges. So if somehow we're going to have a different pool, I'm not sure how they're going to be making, in fact, better or more educated decisions than these judges. So I really just don't understand what they're trying to propose here.
I mean, does it seem as though they are proposing something, anything, just in order to make it appear as though they're doing something?
Definitely. I mean, I think it's clear now, and I think we're at the point now, specifically with immigration and asylum, I think that's, you know, that's not even a point worth making anymore, because that's clearly what they do. Every time there's a crisis, and to be honest, there is a crisis almost every day, every week now, they just have to come up with something suddenly. So whether it's, you know, let's give France a few more £100 million, whether it's, you know, we're going to close down the hotels, even though they know they can't, we're going to smash the gangs. I mean, sort of quite ridiculous ideas they've come up with, haven't they? For instance, when they were talking about how we're going to punish the gangs, it was, you know, we'll ban their companies and companies' house, we'll close down their bank accounts. So, I mean, you know, really, these people, smugglers, aren't really operating via registered companies in the UK, are they? So we know that all of that is just nonsense. So I think this just seems to be another one of those things. Which I think, in many ways, I mean, obviously it's seen otherwise as well, but it is quite disappointing considering Keir Starmer's and so many other cabinet members' backgrounds. They are lawyers. I mean, you know, Keir Starmer would probably himself, quite likely, very likely, have started off his legal practice working in these immigration tribunals. He knows how it works. He knows those judges. So for him to also jump on the bandwagon and try to make out as if the judges are the problem, I think it's really quite disappointing.
But it is a fact, though, that isn't it, that the government is already speeding up the claims process and fewer people are in private hotels now in wait of their claim being processed than was the case last year. So some progress is being made. Is that fair to say?
I think it is, yes. I mean, obviously, that's what government statistics show, working in the field also. I think that is true. Obviously, some of the numbers are going up there for some of the backlog. But obviously, I mean, I don't think it's anywhere near the backlog that the Tories left. Or specifically when Rishi Sunak made that, that claim that will clear the backlog. And the way they then cleared the backlog basically was just implicitly, unilaterally withdrawing people's asylum claims. And so sort of overnight, the number of asylum claims halved. And then the more complicated claims, they said, well, we didn't promise to clear those. So the more complicated ones, I'd have to clear the straightforward ones. So, I mean, obviously, I think the situation is much better than it was. But basically, we need to invest in judges. We invest in courts. We train Home Office caseworkers better. We just generally improve the system rather than, as usual, as it ends up happening, you know, quite frequently in this country, the judges and the courts somehow become the scapegoat. I just don't see how is any of this immigration judge's fault.
We're talking about a relatively few number of people, a tiny percentage of those that come. Most do not arrive by boat. Most arrive by plane Heathrow or some other major airline airport. And they have already been pre-approved by the government. They're coming here perfectly legally. Do you think that we concentrate too much on a relatively few number of people, considering that there's about a million people who come here perfectly legally?
Of course. But I think that's the slippery slope we've been on for many years now, haven't we? That's the basis on which elections are won. That's the basis on which, you know, whole political parties, you know, not just based their manifesto, they've basically been founded on, you know, just talking about that. And I think that's the point. I mean, that is the big problem. And it's not just about within immigration. Why do we only talk about these people? It's within all the problems that this country faces. Why is that the only issue that ever makes the front pages? And I think, you know, I think the figure is probably about 1%, less than 1% asylum seekers or refugees in this country. So, you know, we talk about, you know, there's so many And of those, obviously, the people crossing over on small boats would be much lower than that even. So basically, if we're talking about, you know, 100 people in GP's waiting room, less than one of those persons is going to be someone who came to the UK on a small boat. So, of course, they're not the ones clogging up our public services. They're not the ones, you know, because why our waiting times are so long, why our kids can't get into schools. All those problems have nothing to do with that, really. But obviously, it's a very convenient, you know, scapegoat for the government. And it's something that they can keep talking about. So no one really gets time to, you know, look at or talk about anything else.
You know, we're very aware of this argument, this news story in this country, because it crops up on a daily basis. Do you think that the people who are setting off from French shores to get here are aware of it? Because it's not really the kind of welcome that you would ordinarily have in mind if you make that perilous journey.
Yes, I mean, I think, to be honest, you know, considering, you know, modern forms of communication, social media and so on, I think people are getting the message. So people do know that. But the thing is, like they always say, you know, the only time someone would actually voluntarily, willingly get into the sea is if the land was more dangerous, if the sea is actually safer. So that's the thing, you know, these are desperate people. And we can see now, you know, whether it's famine, whether it's climate change, whether it's war, whether it's invasions, all of these things, obviously millions of people around the world need to get to safety. So, regardless of what this government says, what the media says, what so many politicians say, these people aren't coming here for the £40 a week asylum support they're going to get. They are coming here so they can get to a safe place, eventually at some point, hopefully, be joined by their families.
Do you think that it actually really doesn't matter how fast the claims are processed? The protesters won't be satisfied. It's not really about asylum seekers. It's about a sort of splenetic hatred of foreigners.
To some extent. But also, I think, I mean, in terms of when we talk about the time it takes, the point is, how is that going to... I'm not sure exactly how that's going to placate these people, because what that's basically going to mean is that the people who are going to be granted quicker. And so if for now, you know, hypothetically, 1,000 people's immigration appeals are being allowed, if we start speeding it up and every month 2,000 people get granted asylum through the new immigration tribunal system, actually, is that going to make the situation worse for so many of these right-wing politicians and media? They're just going to say, well, the numbers are going up. But obviously, that's, you know, that's just a natural outcome if you start speeding things up. So I don't really understand how it's going to placate these people, or, you know, what difference it thinks they're going to make. Even the same thing with hotels. So obviously the point is, you know, obviously most of these people, well, firstly, they aren't, I think, quite unacceptably, they aren't allowed to work. So obviously they can't pay their rent, they need a house, the government has to accommodate them. But what difference does it really make whether they're in a hotel or in HMO, or they're given individual houses or a hostel? I don't really see, you know, what, for instance, the High Court judgment, the interim injunction that so many people celebrated, oh, finally our hotels are going to be emptied, but those people are still going to be in our towns and our cities. I just really can't see what the difference it makes. Okay, they're not in a hotel, they're just in a block of flats now.
And what do you make of Nigel Farage's sort of Trump-style promise to get 5 flights a day leaving this country full of asylum seekers?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't think anything like that could happen, hopefully, ever, anything close to that. But obviously, I mean, you know, taking it further, and people, you know, anyone questioning him didn't take it much further, but they just said, okay, you're saying we'll automatically deport people. But what does that mean if someone's going to be tortured or killed somewhere? Would you send them back? And his answer was, well, yes, I'm responsible for the British people. I really don't care what happens. So I think if that's your starting point, that's the baseline, that's the moral values that you're showing when you're starting the conversation, then basically you can say anything, you know. You might as well just push them back into the sea then, if that's the point. Look, you know, we've come to a point, we don't want any more people in Britain. We don't care what happens to you. Fine then, I mean, I guess just start shooting them, you know, if you see a boat crossing over. So to be honest, yeah, I'm not really sure there's much, you know, sort of educated discussion that can be had if that's your starting point.
Good to talk to you, Shoaib. Thanks very much for your time. That's Shoaib Khan, the human rights lawyer. So what do you make of this and the government's announcement that they are going to, A, speed up the processing claims by by organising panels of experts, professional adjudicators, whoever they may be, and also preventing judges from hearing appeals from people who have had their asylum claim rejected. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Who's a good human? Jenny is, because Jenny will always do what's best for Bertie, her bestie Bassett. So if Bertie needs to go and wee, that's what they're going to do. Even if it is 3 a.m. and it's raining cat lots. That's why she also chooses Butternut Box for Bertie's meals. Freshly prepared, served straight from the fridge, and conveniently delivered right to your door. At a time that suits you for once. Hey, Jenny. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
There's plenty of summer still left to enjoy and lots of wines to enjoy it with. At Waitrose, we've got 25% off six or more bottles of wine or fizz over £6, like the citrusy Esprit de Chablis, perfect with chicken on the barbecue, or a Minuti M Special Edition Rosé, bursting with strawberries, grapefruit and delicate peach, and a fruity San Leo Prosecco, best paired with a sunny spot in the garden. Fill the last days of summer and your wine rack with 25% off at Waitrose. Selected stores online, subject to availability, exclude Scotland, boxed wines and bottles priced £100 and
this is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So do you think the government is onto something here, that they have heard the cries of the, what are described as right-wing mobs or rioters or concerned citizens, whatever you might like to call them, the people that have been yelling at hotels, that the answer to this is speeding up the processing of those claims, because as the human rights lawyer I was just talking to pointed out, if you do process the claims more quickly, then that will just mean that they will be given the right to stay here more quickly, and that's probably not what those people have in mind. What are your thoughts on preventing judges from hearing appeals from rejected asylum seekers, given that a half of appeals for those who have been rejected at the moment are then granted at that appeal stage, meaning that it was an incorrect decision in the first place? Are we just going to say, well, to hell with them, we just need these people out, regardless of what the circumstance, and that's the end of it? 0345 6060 973. Aylesbury. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Nick. Thanks for taking my call. And look, I've listened to you lots of times on the on my long nighttime drive, so it's a pleasure to speak in person. What I wanted to say is I think there's a bit of a disconnect, actually, here from what your human rights lawyer was saying. It seems to me that we've got entangled in bureaucracy and legalese, and that what's needed, and I do, you know, commend what the government is aiming to do here, that we need to sort this out a little. I've been voting Liberal Democrat since 1987. My brother stood for the party. He worked head office there for the Lib Dems. And so I'm not naturally one of those, I think you called them splenetic hatred. I can't remember quite the phrase, but, you know, the right-wing mob. And I don't disagree that there would be an element of that in these processes have been happening. But I think, in a nutshell, things have gone too far, and I think we need to adopt the system such as they've been adopting recently in Scandinavia. They call it a hostile environment. It's a bit like Theresa May, perhaps, when she had those vans going around London, you know, saying immigrants out, whatever they said on the signs. But no one would deny a genuine asylum seeker, but I don't think most of these people are, frankly.
Definition, if they are granted asylum, then their asylum claim is genuine.
Well, that's what you would think, and that was certainly the case in 1950 or so, 1951, when we first came up with these rules, when they worked. But, you know, things have moved on since then. There aren't many things I think you and I could think of that worked really well in 1950, and we should never change them a jot. There was a lady, for instance, on Vanessa Feltz's show a couple of weekends ago, who worked in one of these hotels, and she struck me as a credible caller. And she was describing the situation. She said, on average, it costs about $8,000 to come across. Most of these people have been in Europe for several years. They're all young men. And, you know, it's an economic decision. It's not genuine asylum. And that's where I think we've got caught up in the legalese bureaucracy, whatever you want to call it. And that's why, if you like, a fresh head is needed. And I think another thing that's happening here for me is that, you know, I'm from that liberal order, that I think that it's got too far, and that, you know, borders matter. Illegal immigrants should be deported. You know, there are lots, and Matthew Say put it very well in the Times today, when you can go too far in one direction and there's danger in that. And I think that's where we're getting to now.
It's interesting. I mean, that phrase, young men, I mean, the other phrase that people come out with a lot is fighting age men in order to make us fearful. Of course they're young men, because the journey is so perilous that it's, you know, old men and like pregnant women and small children, but very unlikely to embark on that kind of trip because of the dangers. So it's just the is of it makes it more likely that those people will be, you know, relatively young and relatively fit. Is that such a problem? Another phrase you could use is working age men.
Well, you could, and I wouldn't like the phrase fighting age men, because I think that's got quite a few emotions attached to it. It seems implausible, because I think most of them have been in completely safe political countries, for several countries, if they've got from, say, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, wherever it may be, and they've got to the UK shores, then by definition they've gone through numerous, in fact, safe countries.
Yeah.
And this can't be political asylum.
But the other side of that is, why should we, just by dint of our geography, not help anybody, whereas the countries in between have soaked up the vast majority of the people who have made that trip? France takes more than we do. Why should we take none?
I'm not saying that we should, shirk our share, as it were.
I thought that's what you were implying. I mean, what's our share then? What percentage?
Well, that's a question about how we use our foreign aid budget.
It's not.
The economist, yes, it is. I mean, because I think, you know, charity, it means, you know, giving to others. And
we're not giving to others abroad. The money, what little that is being spent, is being spent on them when they're here, not abroad. I mean, if we did spend our foreign aid budget better, perhaps abroad, then perhaps those people might not feel the need to make the trip in the first place. But, you know, that's kind of a different issue.
Well, no, I think we might have common ground there. I think that there was a good report in The Economist on this a couple of weeks ago, and it said that, you know, talking about how you deal with, what's the fix for a global asylum, there's never been more migration than there is now.
Hmm.
And one of the things they were saying is that, look, migrants generally fit in better when they have to flee a land or leave a land if they go to a local area. So they gave the example of lots of Syrians, several million, went to Turkey.
The vast majority of people that flee for whatever reason end up either displaced within their own country or just over the border in the next country over.
Yes, but I guess the key thing is, it's like countries with a similar culture. So, for example, Ukrainians fit in really well here. You know, I'm really glad to have them. For instance, Hong Kongers, I think, you know, I'm really glad to have them. They face, you know, obviously very serious, genuine political asylum. But I think my impression is that most of those people coming over the boats aren't political political migrants at all, but rather economic ones.
Right, but you've said that a few times, but you're not really basing that assumption on any facts. It's just a feeling you've got.
You might say that, but I think the facts are rather being deliberately withheld.
By whom?
Some government statistics are published and some aren't.
So you're saying that the government is... That your contention that people are coming here as economic migrants is a fact, but we only don't know that fact because the government is withholding that information.
No, I'm not quite saying that. I'm saying my instinct is that all of these people who've been in safe Western European countries, not all of them, but most of them have been in safe Western European countries for several years.
Well, we don't know the several years part, but we do know that they've come through other safe countries. But as we're going around in a tight circle here, Jeff, but as most of the people who have come through those countries have stayed in those countries, and a very small percentage have actually made their way here, a tiny trickle compared to the flood, say, in Greece and, you know, the southern European countries.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I come back to the point, why should we be absolved of any responsibility to those people, assuming that they are coming here for genuine reasons, and most of them most of them we're led to believe are coming for genuine reasons, because most of them get their case approved. But interesting point, and good to talk to you, Jeff. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. What do you make of this? The government saying they're going to speed up the processing of claims, which probably won't appeal to the people who have been complaining outside hotels, because it would mean that they are, that the majority of them would be given right to remain. I suspect that the people outside hotels aren't really complaining about that they're in hotels. They're complaining about that they're here at all. And what do you make of the claim by Yvette Cooper that she is going to prevent judges from hearing appeals, given that half of all appeals are overturned? The rejection is overturned on appeal, meaning that half of the original decision that is appealed against was wrong. Are we just to say, forget it? We don't care? 0345 6060 973. So more of your thoughts on this to come. Going to take a break for the news, after which we're going to talk about the latest developments in Gaza as Israel starts to ramp up its attack in Gaza City. It's just past 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The Conservatives are accusing the government of not going far enough with a promise to speed up the appeals process for asylum seekers. Ministers want to see judges taken out of the equation and shorten the wait for a decision from more than a year. A man's been hit in the face with a petrol bomb while reportedly putting up flags in Hertfordshire. Police in Stevenage say he was hit by a glass bottle containing a lit rag on Saturday lunchtime, and 140 people have been arrested at and around the Notting Hill Carnival in West London. The Met says 35 were detained on approaches to the event. The figures cover Sunday up until 7:45 p.m. LBC weather largely dry with variable cloud overnight. Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland could have some drizzle. We'll see a low in places of 14 degrees.
This is LBC.
It's a chill summer's day. The twins are splashing in the paddling pool while Mrs. Thing puts her feet up. She's proper chuffed, having saved money on a British Gas boiler service. Now just £69, down from £109, with a free British Gas membership. Bliss. Well, it was nice while it lasted. British Gas, taking care of things. T's and C's apply. Applies to first year of annual boiler service only and renews at standard pricing. Membership required. Available to new boiler service contract customers. Ends 9th of September. Service by 30th of September.
All those glasses are a great choice. And now you can pick a free pair from our Boots range.
Free?
That's right.
What, free free?
Absolutely. There's hundreds to choose from too.
For free? Does the manager know?
I am the manager.
Oh, in that case, how do these look?
With buy one, get one free at Boots Opticians, everyone can save in style. Book an eye test today and see what's possible. Free Boots pair when you spend £150 on prescription glasses or sunglasses. Offer ends 23rd of September 2025. T's and C's apply.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-grid adventure. But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge. Helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So, more of your thoughts on the ongoing row about asylum seekers in hotels or just here at all. That's to come, 0345 6060 973. But let's talk about what's happening in Gaza for a short while. Planes and tanks have pounded parts of Gaza City as Israel's plans to seize the territory's largest urban area increase pressure on nearly a million Palestinians living there. Residents have spoken of uninterrupted explosions in northern and eastern parts of the city. Arash, which is Arash, let's talk to Arash Azizi, who is a contributing writer at The Atlantic, a lecturer at Yale University and author of the book What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. Good evening, Arash.
Good evening to you. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for your time. Israel is not just attacking Gaza, is it? It's also launching attacks on Yemen. What are its objectives there?
That's right. The Yemeni capital is controlled by a government really unrecognized by Iran and a few places, Houthis, which is sort of an adversary of Israel. So Israel is trying to push them back. It has for a while. But Israel now finds itself in a situation where in the last year it has attacked Yemen, it has attacked Syria, it has attacked Lebanon, it has attacked Iran, it has attacked Iraq, and of course it's attacking Gaza. So, it's fighting on a few fronts.
Yeah, and in Gaza City, the Israelis have already destroyed over 1,000 buildings. Is there much of it left?
Unfortunately, so much in Gaza City is destroyed. And as we know, so much of the rest of Gaza is destroyed. This is quite clearly, by any standards, a war with no end in sight. The families of the hostages, and the Israeli hostages, have long called for an end to this war. They know that the negotiated deal is what will bring their loved ones home. Ostensibly, this was to be the goal of the war. But we know that members of the far-right Israeli cabinet openly called for the annexation of Gaza, of settlement of Gaza by Israeli citizens, and by killing residents of Gaza. So the recent attacks on Gaza City and the plans to occupy them is just one more step in this endless war, whose purpose seems to be just prolonging the career of Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister, and his far-right government.
There have been protests. There was a national strike, wasn't there, just this week in Israel. Are the Israeli people tiring of this, or are they tiring of their government?
I think they're tiring both of the war and of the government. Hundreds of thousands of people took part in these protests. Many Israelis see their loved ones, getting drafted to the army and going for new rounds of fighting in Gaza, and they ask themselves, for what? For what purpose? For what end? So I think there is increasing impatience over the government and over the war in Gaza. Of course, Israeli politics is complicated. There are very different sort of political parties on the left, on the right. There's sort of sectoral parties that represent different sections of Israeli society. And so it's not like there's not a huge lurch to the left or anything like that. But I think there is a lot of unpopularity for Netanyahu and for the war, as shown by the sheer number of people who've showed up to these recent protests. Although, at some point, Israel will have to go to elections. And there it's very likely that we'll see new parties founded by parties that don't exist right now, founded by figures, some from the Israeli military, some like Naftali Bennett, who used to be prime minister before, as well as the current centrist left-wing and right-wing parties. And then we'll see what will be the fate of Netanyahu. But he's been able to become Israel's longest-reigning prime minister by often exploiting divisions in Israeli politics to his favor.
Yeah, and in the meantime, about half of the Gaza Strip's population of about 2.3 million people live in and around Gaza City. Now, the Israelis have told them to leave to a safe space in the south. Is there a safe space for them to go?
Well, this is a ludicrous thing that Israelis now do. It's very personal to me as an Iranian. I remember when Israel at like 2 a.m. declared that people should evacuate Tehran at some point. Tehran, a city of 10 million, the capital of Iran. How do you evacuate it? Of course, many Tehranis did leave at some point. But that really shows the ludicrousness of such things. The same thing for Gaza City. Gaza as a whole is attacked everywhere. From the very beginning, it's been clear that no place of it is real safe. Of course, there's real hunger going on. And the Israeli attacks are not recognized by so many sources as a genocide. So no, people in Gaza have nowhere safe to go while this war is going on.
Now, the Commissioner General of the UN Relief and Works Agency says Gaza is, and this is the quote, hell in all shapes. And they cite an ongoing famine. The Israelis say there is no genocide and there is no famine. Who to believe?
You know, we can believe so many voices, international organizations, different voices in Israeli society. Read the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which is, you know, the equivalent of Guardian in Israel. It's not some far left paper. It's a sort of paper of the center left in Israel, where there are increasingly voices, you know, about famine and hunger. And frankly, this is so see through. It's not very hard to see that for generations to come. You know, tweets of the Israeli government claiming that there is no hunger in Gaza will be used and shown as a shameful denial of a reality so clear to the world. If you are to believe the Israeli government, there is a conspiracy all around the world for United Nations, for human rights organizations, including Israeli human rights organizations, for you know, different genocide experts. For everybody to fabricate this thing to besmirch Israel. But there is no such fabrication. It's quite clear that the atrocities are happening in Gaza, war crimes are happening by Israel, and that there is widespread hunger and famine now, as recognized by IPC, which does not reach its results very easily. So I think things are quite clear for anybody who wants to see.
Journalists on the other side of the line and non-governmental organisations who are trying to supply aid say that it is being stopped. It is that the Israelis are preventing the aid from getting through. Why would the Israelis suggest that people move to safety and yet deny aid organisations to provide that safety?
Well, that shows, as I said, the ludicrousness of this claim. From the very beginning of this war, it's been very clear, it's very clear that Israel has very little concept of, on holding itself to any standards in Gaza. They'll go wherever they want. They'll commit whatever atrocities they can. And they've shown very little regard for the people of Gaza. I mean, they're very openly threatened. Very openly said in their own words that they're going to cut off all supplies to Gaza several times. So it's no surprise that they're doing that. I mean, of course, we have members of the Israeli government who've gone on the record that they don't care what happens to children in Gaza, let alone anybody else. So, you know, it would be very hard for, regardless of what side of politics you're on, it would be very hard for anyone who follows this war to think that the Israeli government has the slightest regard for the people of Gaza, unfortunately.
It is quite difficult getting information now because journalists are not allowed to document what is happening. Is that standard practice in a war?
You know, of course it's not a standard practice. It should be possible for journalists to go to war scenes. And it's a classic case. Only a government who has something to hide stops journalists from going. And there are journalists across the political spectrum, you know, right-wing, left-wing, centrist, from many different countries who've asked, allow us to go and report freely on this war. If your claims are true, allow us to go and report freely. And yet Israelis have not done that. It's no surprise from someone like Netanyahu, who barely speaks to the Israeli media. You know, he loves giving press interviews where he won't be challenged in the United States or other places. But you have trouble finding him speak, you know, in length to Israeli media, his own country's journalists. So these are tactics of a government who has a lot to hide.
My eye was taken by an alarming statistic that the proportion of the dead in Gaza that are civilians is over 80%. Is that unprecedented for any war? And that's the Israeli military's own data, I believe.
Yes, this is a report, I think, that the folks at Plus 972 magazine, a great Israeli magazine, an Israeli-Palestinian magazine written by both Israelis and Palestinians, I believe they're working on a report that shows that. And you know, important to acknowledge the hard work they've done there. I'm not sure if it's unprecedented. I don't think it would be unprecedented, but it never, and you know, the numbers can change here and there. But there's no doubt that it shows the, you know, the sort of really criminal nature of this war from its very beginning. Again, you know, you really, if you just look at this war from early on, it's quite clear that there's very little regard for civilian life. You know, regardless of what you want to believe, again, this should not be a partisan issue. Anybody who seriously looks at this, regardless of what position they had on Israel, you know, before the war began, it's quite clear this is not a government that is trying to save civilian lives or cares for civilian lives. I mean, the Israeli Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, back then Minister of Defense, early on in the war said that we are fighting human animals in Gaza. And if you think the people you are fighting are human animals, how are you going to care for their welfare? Which is why, by the way, Gallant and Netanyahu, of course, are indicted and wanted at the International Criminal Court in The Hague because of their crimes. And we can all hope, just like the perpetrators of previous crimes in Serbia, in Yugoslavia, in other places, or Vladimir Putin, who is also wanted by the same court in The Hague, we can all hope that one day they'll go there to face justice. It's what Palestinians deserve, and frankly, it's also what the people of Israel finally deserve to see, that these leaders are brought to justice.
And just finally, when Israel takes Gaza City, then what?
Well, the Israelis, from the very beginning, have also had no conception of a day after. If you look at early on, after the war, the question was, okay, what's going to happen after? What is Israel's plan for day after in Gaza? When this war finally ends, what do they want to do there? They don't want to hand that out to Hamas, which is a terrorist organization, but they also don't want to hand it to the Palestinian Authority, which is the recognized state of Palestinians, the state of Palestine, as recognized as such by many countries, hopefully soon by the UK as well. The next month, UK is to recognize it. They don't want to do that either. They don't want to give it to the Arab countries who all support the right of a state of Palestine to rule it over. So unfortunately, all we can see is that the plan of the Israeli government, from, you know, based on the statements of its own members, is to continue something like a de facto annexation of the place and potentially expanding over there. But I do believe that they don't have a free hand in that forever. And I do believe if the global pressure goes on, if not at France, United Kingdom, you know, Sweden, Spain, Slovenia, so many Ireland, so many other countries recognize the state of Palestine, they will also work with Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, and other Arab and Muslim countries, to put pressure on Israel to be able to, you know, push it to go out of Gaza and allow the state of Palestine to take over there. It would take a lot of work. Probably need a change of government in Israel, but I think that should be the direction. I think the, you know, international community, you know, needs to bring unprecedented pressure in order to not let Gaza, you know, which has been destroyed already to this degree, to also become victim to some sort of an endless occupation. You know, and I think that it's important, if Israel doesn't want to think about the day after, but the other countries in the region, the Arab countries, and also the, you know, European Western countries, international community as a whole must think about the day after.
Good to talk to you, Arash. Thanks very much for your time. That's Arash Azizi, contributing writer at The Atlantic, lecturer at Yale University, and author of the book What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. Right, we're going to take a short break, then back to your thoughts about the government's proposal to sort of quell the ire of the people who are shouting at hotels.
Coming up next week on LBC, Penny Mordaunt.
That we want to demonstrate to people who might be partners in the future that we can be trusted, that they can work with us in this way.
Emily Thornberry.
Zelensky doesn't trust Putin, and there are times when you wonder just how much Trump trusts Putin and seems to be quite naive about it.
James Cleverly.
It didn't have to be like this. We were closing asylum hotels. We had a series of plans.
Ed Davey.
I'm still pretty worried that Donald Trump just wants to do a deal with Vladimir Vladimir Putin, and that comes first rather than the interest of Ukraine.
4 days, four voices. Starts Tuesday from 10 a.m. Only on LBC.
Train to Bedford with the crew for a music festival. Scenes.
Georgie, is this too much glitter?
Yep, lost them. God, I offered to get drinks on my own. It's okay, find the flag with the DJ and Cat. Oh, there they are. Back on the train, glitter gone, feet destroyed. Totally worth it. Oh, I can't wait to post this selfie of us.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book tickets and save one third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
If I need an eye test, I don't go to Specsavers.
One thing you won't see at Specsavers is me.
Do I go?
Yes!
I mean, no. Me? I don't go to Specsavers. Nor you, eh, Spike?
Should have gone to Specsavers. Nah.
Hi, Specsavers. Here for your eye test.
They come to me instead.
Come in. Kettle's on.
Thank you.
If you can't go to Specsavers unaccompanied, we could come to you. See if you're eligible at specsavers.co.uk/home visits.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Have I won a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6.
T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, we are talking about government plans to set up a new independent panel focused on asylum appeals to help reduce the backlog. This is after a wave of anti-migrant protests that continued today. 0345 6060 973, Portsmouth. Dave.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick point around the assertion that you've made a couple of times in the last hour or so around the fact that where someone is granted, it means that, well, they must have qualified for asylum. It must be valid. I just want to say that's not necessarily true, because what happens in an appeal court is the individual asylum seeker, the appellant as they're known, all they have to do is prove to a reasonable degree of likelihood, not beyond reasonable doubt. It's not a criminal standard in the immigration context. So just to a reasonable degree of likelihood that there will be a future risk to them if they return to their home country. Now, that's very easy to do, because all you've got to do is rehearse your story, make sure you've done a sort of a dry run with a friend or your solicitor, and solicitors often coach them to say the right thing, and then you're home and dry.
Well, you could say that about any about the law in full, couldn't you? I mean, people get coached by their solicitors to say what they think the judge wants to hear. I mean, I don't really see what you're saying.
Yeah, but in a criminal case, you would have to prove it beyond reasonable doubt. In the immigration court, you don't have to prove it beyond reasonable doubt. You just need to prove there's no reasonable degree of likelihood, and you get coached. And there's also country guidance cases. And what those country guidance cases do is they set out the standard or the yardstick by which someone would qualify for asylum. And if you go to these immigration courts, there's a couple in London, one in Feltham, one in Rosebery Avenue in Angel Islington. These are open courts. You could walk in, I could walk in, any one of your listeners could walk in. I was going to say tomorrow, not tomorrow, it's a bank holiday. You could walk in on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday next week, and there's always asylum cases being heard.
Hmm.
And you will hear.
But they're not being heard by idiots, though, are they? I mean, if you can show a reasonable degree of likelihood, then does that not sound like a reasonable degree of likelihood? I mean, that sounds like, you know, if they say yes, then yes means yes, no?
That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that all of these asylum seekers, depending on which country you're talking about, give the same story. It's almost identical.
But then the implication you're making is that the person who is judging these cases is some sort of naive fool.
Well, no, because their hands are tied. Their hands are tied, because if the individual before them is giving evidence which is consistent with the country guidance case and it meets what is a relatively low standard of proof, i.e. the balance of probabilities, that judge's hands are tied. They would have to grant asylum. So what I'm saying to you is, Nick, I could probably coach you within 24 hours to qualify for asylum from any country in the world. I could coach you to do that. I could coach you to give a story, if you're an Afghan national, that you are the son of a commander, a senior commander who fought with the British Army and therefore is at risk from the Taliban. Or I could coach you to say you're homosexual, therefore you are at risk if you go back to Iran. There are certain stories that fit each country that is common for where asylum seekers come from. So Eritrea,
okay.
Ethiopia.
Well, how would you counteract then? How would you counteract that then?
If I knew the answer to that, Nick, I'd be a very, very wealthy man. The truth is that you can't counteract it if you are going to have the balance of probabilities. You could potentially counteract it by increasing the standard of proof, but what you do then is you risk a small number of cases where individuals that might genuinely be entitled to asylum being returned to their home country and then facing the consequences, which obviously nobody would want to see. So it's a really difficult question. But, you know, I'll come back to my point that there are immigration courts up and down the country, and you will hear the same story over and over and over again. And that's because legal reps, and there are some that really do hog some cases from particular nationalities, one beginning with W in particular. It will take on cases from a particular country, and they will coach their clients to say the right thing. Now, that's illegal for the legal rep to do, but the authorities cannot prove it. It's impossible to prove that. But when you've got individuals telling the exact same story, you know there's something awry. And if you talk to people in the community where asylum seekers often come from, your Eritreans, your Ethiopians, your Afghanistans, what you'll find is they often return to their home country. And I think your first caller made the point. Within 2-3 years, once they've got their asylum status, they will happily not only go back to their country, they're paying for a ticket to go back to the country to which they claim their life is in danger. But they're paying hundreds of pounds for a ticket to go there voluntarily.
Right. Well, you can say that easily enough, but there's no evidence that I've seen or that you've presented that is actually true. But some interesting points. Thanks for that. Andrew in Penzance says, what I want to know is why the Farage rioters aren't on the streets demanding to know the nationality of the people who set fire to the Indian restaurant in Ilford. Well, I think we know the reason for that, don't we? Carol says, Tory MP Robert Jenrick, interviewed on Sky News in 2022, bragged that he ramped up the use of hotels to house asylum seekers and now attacks Labour for doing the very same thing. Farage's words have consequences. It's not them ending up in hospital with serious head injury, attacked by white vigilante groups. Yeah, well, he's seen a golden opportunity and he's gone for it. Southampton, hello, David.
Hello, yeah. I mean, I think this whole system is ridiculous. Why are we paying for this? It's ridiculous. I mean, all these people are exploiting the system.
All these people are exploiting...
asylum seekers, most of them are economic migrants. You got all the lawyers who are in on the system exploiting. It's ridiculous, the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, so we can't take all these people from around the world. I mean,
if we didn't have migrants, then this would be a considerably poorer country.
Yeah, but the system is getting corrupted with all the. I mentioned obviously it's not just the illegal or the boat people. The high number of legal migrants is too many as well. The whole thing is out of control. But you know, you've got like the previous caller said, they're exploiting the system. They can't be deported easily.
Right. Well, I don't know that they are all being that they are all exploiting the system. And
I'm not saying all. A lot of them are.
Okay. Well, that give me a number. You've got absolutely no idea.
I don't know.
Right.
I mean, obviously, it's out of control because they fine thousands of pounds to cross Europe, cross the world to get to the UK. You know, they're just exploiting the system. They're economic migrants. A lot of them are.
But in a country that is in need of people of working age to actually do jobs that Brits don't want to do, it doesn't really matter whether they're economic migrants.
Yeah,
in fact, it's a good thing if they're economic migrants. They want to come here and do work that would otherwise not be done, and pay the tax that is associated with that. What difference does it make whether they're economic migrants?
Yeah, but they're a burden on other services.
No, they're not. Just saying it, David, doesn't make it so. the average UK-based migrant from Europe contributed £2,300 more to the UK public finances than the average UK adult. Bizarrely, we'd actually be better off with an entire country of migrants. We'd be richer. The average European migrant who came to the UK goes on to contribute £78,000 more than they take out in public services and benefits over the course of their time spent in the UK. That's the European migrants. Now, we've made sure that they don't get here. The average non-European migrant also delivers a net positive contribution during their time in the UK of £28,000. All the people outside, all those sort of the toothless underclass who are outside these hotels screaming at them, they, to me, look like they have been a drain on society their entire lives. They'll scream at the police and throw bricks at hotels and try and set them on fire, and then, and the evidence is in the number of people who were arrested last summer for the riots there, about half of them then go home to beat up their girlfriends. You know, women would be safer in asylum hotels than in the homes of the people who are complaining outside asylum hotels. But run out of time on that one. Thanks for that. Sorry I couldn't get through to all your calls and the messages. Now, we're going to change it up after the news. Government analysis has revealed that Sir Keir Starmer's winter fuel cuts will hit around 600,000 disabled pensioners this winter. This is despite the government's U-turn on its original decision to strip winter fuel payments from millions of pensioners. The cut's now restricted to those earning more than £35,000 a year. Critics have said that this threshold is still too low. Will you be affected? And is there any way the government can make this policy work for the majority of people? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, a human rights lawyer has been telling LBC the government's new push to speed up the appeals process for asylum seekers should start with improving Home Office decision-making. Around 51,000 cases are believed to be stuck in a backlog. It typically takes around a year for conclusions to be made on individual appeal cases. But Shoaib Khan has been telling LBC there is a reason those numbers are so large.
Almost half, usually it's between 50 to 60% every year, of immigration asylum appeals are allowed, which basically means at least half of the decisions the Home Office is making are wrong. So if they just got the decision right in the first place, then so many cases wouldn't go to appeal.
An investigation has begun in Hertfordshire after a man was hit with a petrol bomb while reportedly putting up flags in Stevenage. Police say he suffered a head injury after a glass bottle containing a lit rag was thrown on Saturday lunchtime. 140 people have been arrested at and around the Notting Hill Carnival in West London. The Metropolitan Police says 35 were detained on approaches to the event. The figure covers a time period up until 7:45 on Sunday evening. Residents in Gaza City are reporting more strikes from Israeli planes and tanks. They say buildings and homes have been destroyed in the eastern and northern outskirts after Israeli leaders said the push to take control of the city would continue. Contributing writer at The Atlantic, Arash Azizi, has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC most of Gaza is becoming a wasteland.
So much in Gaza City is destroyed, and as we know, so much of the rest of Gaza is destroyed. This is quite clearly, by any standards, a war with no end in sight. The families of the hostages and the Israeli hostages have long called for an end to this war.
A man's died after a fire at a residential building in London. He was found dead inside it after it began on Dorset Road in Oval just before midnight. Russia and Ukraine have exchanged 146 prisoners of war from each side. The swap has come about following mediation by the United Arab Emirates. And bus passengers could be banned from playing loud music under proposals set out by the Conservatives. They want to put forward changes to a bill which is currently going through Parliament. The Tories also say that rail passengers could benefit from a tougher enforcement of existing rules. LBC weather, largely dry with variable cloud overnight. Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland could see some drizzle, and there'll be a low of around 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Fuel cuts will apparently hit around 600,000 disabled pensioners, the government's analysis of the policy has found. Let's talk about this with Simon Francis. Simon is the coordinator of End Fuel Poverty Coalition. Hello, Simon.
Hello.
Many people would have thought, perhaps, that this policy had been cancelled by the government to cut the winter fuel allowance. What is this policy now?
So what the government did is they've essentially changed the criteria that you have to fulfil in order to be eligible to the winter fuel payment. So they've eased it slightly so more people are going to be able to benefit from it. But the challenge is still the same challenge, really, as last year, in that there is still a cliff edge. So if you're a household and you're earning more than £35,000 a year, then that becomes a cliff edge, and you don't get a penny after that. And for many people who are disabled, may well fall into that, but obviously for people who are disabled they may well have much greater costs. So one of the things that we had been urging the government to do is to think about making an exception for people who are disabled and who might have a slightly higher income than this threshold, but because of the additional costs of being disabled, and especially the additional energy costs, so even if just for instance charging a wheelchair or running an extra fridge to keep medicines cool, that's all adding to people's bills, especially during the winter, and that's one of the reasons why when it comes to looking at means-tested benefits, you do need to think about kind of people who perhaps just miss out.
Yes, being disabled does mean that you have to shell out for things that people who aren't might not even think about.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not just the sort of the fixed one-off costs, but it's also the ongoing costs of running a home. I mean, you could also add into this people who also have long-term health conditions, for whom, you know, actually keeping your home warm is medically important, to stay warm, so you're not putting additional strain on your body. So, you know, one of the things that we know is living in cold, damp homes can be really difficult for people who have long-term health conditions, such as your heart conditions, for example. Actually, it's the same even if it's a home that is too warm as well. So even in the summer, we need to think about this as well. But you know, this is one of the, you know, these are one of the people who we really need to think again about, and like encourage the government to think about what more it can do to provide support for those particular individuals for whom, you know, it's really important to stay warm, to have support with your energy costs.
You would have thought that the government would, I mean, this is their own figures, that they would understand this. So why do you think that they're taking this stand?
I think it's probably just a case of doing something that's administratively easier to do. I think it does come down to that. I think government and certainly some ministers do understand the challenges, but ultimately it's the Treasury that makes these decisions, and the Treasury says, yeah, we've got to do things in an easy way, and that we've got to keep the cost down as much as possible. But of course, you know, it becomes a false economy, because if if people are ill or relying more on the NHS, then of course then that is going to increase the costs to the government for the services that people then turn to.
Notwithstanding the particular needs of the disabled, do you think that 35,000 is a fair cut-off point?
I mean, they obviously had to come up with a cut-off point somewhere. I think what we would have preferred them to have done is to have a taper, so that, okay, so you know, people who are £1 over aren't automatically excluded from it. That's certainly what we asked them to do, and obviously they've not done it on this occasion. But what we're looking forward to in the future is, you know, we can't just have these sort of piecemeal support packages available, you know, for people who are struggling with their energy bills. What we need to see is a more comprehensive strategy. And that's why we've been urging the government to introduce a social tariff for energy. So for those people who do have existing health conditions or medical needs, or who are disabled, or who are struggling to keep their homes warm in the winter because of, you know, their age or their income, are given support through a reduced tariff. And that's something that we've been calling for now for several years. And the last government promised they were going to run a consultation on it. This government was originally, you know, sounding positive about it, but it's all gone very quiet. And that's what we need to see, is a long-term strategy, because we don't want to have to keep on having this conversation every single winter.
Yes, so, I mean, you mentioned people on low income. 35,000 is quite a lot of money to a large section of the country. I mean, if you're on minimum wage and you do and you work full time, then you're on about £24,000, and yet those people will get nothing. Am I right?
Indeed, I mean, you need to look at this as a much broader, the social tariff needs to be a much broader package of support that's available for people. One thing that more people will get this winter, though, is the warm home discount. So that is being changed. So there's another several million households now going to be eligible for that. Again, it's going to be based on means-tested benefits. So again, it's not going to cover everyone. But it is another part of support that is going to be available for people. And people should check that if you are on means-tested benefit, make sure it's your name that's on the energy bill. So that the energy firms can match you to the system. And if you feel like it's not or it isn't, then get in touch with your energy firm so they know who you are and they know that they can apply this discount to your bill come the winter.
And what is the nature of the discount?
So it's £150 off energy bills in the winter. So it is a significant amount of money for people to have, and it will go to people who are also getting winter fuel payments as well. So, you know, it is, you know, there is now more support this winter than there certainly was last winter, which is welcome. But as I say, what we would really need to see is a long-term solution to this, because, you know, energy bills, you know, there's going to be a price cap announcement on Wednesday. We expect it's going to show there's going to be a very small increase in bills again come the winter. You know, but overall, we're still in the fifth winter now, coming up to the fifth winter of the energy bills crisis. You know, these record prices, often set because of the cost of gas, you know, is going to keep coming for as long as for the foreseeable future. And that's why we need to see a long-term support plan put in place.
You know, some people might think, well, we're talking about £300 for the winter fuel allowance. That's 84 pence a day. They might say, how is someone on over 35,000 a year going to miss 84p a day? What's your answer to that?
I think the way that it mounts up, though, is the fact that over the winter, people are using much more than they would normally do for their energy. And what we see is, if people don't have the confidence to put on the heating, then they let their homes run into, they sort of, what we call, the industry calls, they self-disconnect. They use less than they need to keep themselves warm. And what happens when that happens is that people end up then either becoming ill, or if they have pre-existing health conditions, they become worse. And then it means people turn more to the NHS. You know, if you've got children in the home, and obviously this is a slightly different issue, but if you've got children in the home, there's actually research that shows that if you're living in a cold, damp home, your cognitive development slows down. So, you know, this is really serious, not just from a sort of a public health point of view, but an education point of view as well. You know, this is why fixing, you know, cold, damp homes is really important. And that's why we need to see investment, not just in our energy efficiency of our buildings and helping people improve their homes, but also in what we've called the social tariff, so that there's support every winter. And also, we need to start thinking about the future. You know, the research that came out recently showed that from 2027, the North Sea, even if we opened up all the new fields, wouldn't be able to produce enough gas to power the heating in our homes. So we need to think about what's going to happen in the future. We can't be increasingly dependent on imports, which are going to be priced on volatile global markets, concentrated in the hands of a few companies. What we need to think about is what happens in the future, and what happens with our electricity price, which is going to be really important to see if we can drive that down, so that people can heat their homes using electricity and keep themselves warm, as I say, that the North Sea essentially runs out of gas.
And am I right in thinking that electricity is price dependent on the price of gas?
Well, absolutely. So, yes, this is this marginal pricing system where basically the cost of electricity is set by the most expensive form of electricity generation, and that is usually a gas-fired power station. So, I mean, it's like if you went to a bar and you were charged as if every drink you ordered was the most expensive one on the menu rather than the one that you wanted. So, you know, we need to see the government get a grip of that, because, you know, gas-fired electricity costs around £114 per megawatt hour, and that compares to £41 a megawatt hour for solar, for example. It's a bit more for offshore wind, £44. So, you know, we need to see the government again look at this pricing system and make sure that the reforms that it brings forward on this issue do address this point, so that we can break that link between the expensive cost of gas-fired electricity power from, you know, cheaper renewables.
And back to the winter fuel allowance, I mean, the alternative to having a cut-off or having a taper after, say, £35,000 is to give it to everyone. What are your thoughts on that?
And that's obviously what did happen until, you know, just 2 years ago. I think people... there's varying views on how effective that was, and obviously there were stories of people using it not for their energy bills, but there were also stories of people who would use that money and every year they'd donate it to their local food bank, for example, or to an energy poverty charity. So there's sort of different ways that people were using that money. I think everyone sort of acknowledged that there needed to be some reform of the winter fuel payments. But obviously everyone remembers last winter, where the Chancellor went far too far, and cut it to hardly, so there was very, very few people who got it. And, you know, we did see an impact in terms of, the impact on the NHS and in terms of people who suffered as a result of that.
Yeah. The difficulty the government has is that giving everybody the winter fuel allowance payment might not be fair to the low-paid worker who will never make £35,000, who will essentially be subsidising those better off than them.
So the winter fuel payment obviously is paid for through the general taxation system. So every bit of tax revenue helps fund the winter fuel payment. It's not sort of a direct transfer. But, you know, I take the point that, you know, we did need to see some form of reform to the winter fuel payment. How it was done last winter with no consultation and at very short notice was not the right way to do something. And that's why there was so much anger from people who felt like the government was taking away something that people had come to rely on. And now we do have this reform system. There is a threshold in place, and there are now support for people who are on lower incomes through the Warm Homes discount, although it's not as much. But as I say, this is where we need to see a longer term program, so that people who are struggling, and we know there are millions and millions of homes, people have not just pensioners, but, people who are struggling with the cost of their energy. And we need to see support for all of them until we can take the measures and we can see the reforms come through that are going to improve energy efficiency, that are going to bring down the total of people's bills. And also until we can see the reform of pricing, especially, as we mentioned, the cost of electricity.
You know, the way that some of the press reported the winter fuel allowance cuts were that the government was just being, particularly malicious, almost sort of delighting in their cruelty. Do you have any sympathy with them? Because they took over what was a pretty poor state of affairs from the Conservative Party, and every proposal that they put forward, VAT on schools, farm landowners' inheritance tax, mansion tax, you name it, some lobby group cries foul. It's almost as though they're thinking, well, what can we do?
Yeah, I think what we struggled with last summer and into last winter was the fact that the government made this choice that affected pensioners, knowing full well the impact that it would have, because when they were in opposition, the Conservatives tried to do the same thing a couple of years ago, and the backlash meant they dropped the proposals. Then when Labour came into power, they did the very thing that they had said they weren't going to do and that they had opposed when the Conservatives suggested it. So not only did they go back on something that we thought was going to be safe in terms of support for older people, but also they did it without any consultation and without giving people notice. If they'd said last year, right, well, this is the last year of this being a universal payment to all pensioners, let's start having a conversation about how we can target this better, we could have had a whole year of working with ministers to actually come up with a better policy. Instead, what happened was that was just taken away. And we had to then spend, that time arguing about why it was so important that we should give support to pensioners, because unless we do, then we do see increased problems in terms of people turning to the NHS, and we did see increases in the number of people dying last winter. So, That was a political decision, and I think it was a tactically for them, politically as much as it a mistake, and obviously for those households who had come to rely on the winter fuel payments last winter, was deeply upsetting and deeply shocking, and did cause suffering.
Yeah, the positive side to this is the government says that state pensions will rise by £1,900 a year during this Parliament. Does this row sort of ignore that?
I think it's a strange way of looking at it, but I mean, certainly the row over winter fuel payments certainly put into focus just how important it is that we do give support to people with their energy bills, and just how much certain people are struggling, even with the state pension, as you mentioned. But again, a lot of pensioner groups will say, it's not enough. Is it really safe? And as we've talked about, for those pensioners who have additional health needs, either that's having to keep their home warm because they've got a long-term health condition, or it's because they're disabled, then they do, of course, have additional costs, and they do need even more support.
Very good to talk to you, Simon. Thanks so much for that. That's Simon Francis, coordinator of the End Fuel Poverty Coalition. So, Keir Starmer's winter fuel cuts, big issue last year, changed his mind, and the policy is now that those earning £35,000 or less will receive the winter fuel allowance worth up to £300, which may come on top of the warm home discount, which is a separate payment of about £150. So what do you make of this? Do you think that those on £35,000 should get a winter fuel allowance? Is it a bit odd that it's a hard border between those earning less than and those earning more than £35,000, that is the cut-off line, or should it be more tapered than that? And do you really need it if you earn that much? 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850. Email nicka@lbc.co.uk. If you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone. 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
How will you react if you win big with Win Plus?
I can't believe it!
Enter now at winplus.co.uk to get in the draw. 18 plus GB only. T's and C's apply.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with a McDonald's side mission. Do you, A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, we are talking about the winter fuel allowance for the second winter in a row. Well, not winter yet, but it's charging upon us. And Keir Starmer's winter fuel cuts will hit around 600,000 disabled pensioners. That is the government's own analysis of the policy. The Prime Minister's decision to restrict the payment to those earning £35,000 or less will see more than 2 million pensioners miss out on the allowance, which is worth up to £300. But if you are earning, let's say, £35,000, do you really need an extra £300 on top of that to pay your gas or electricity bill? And of the 600,000 disabled pensioners, perhaps we should make a blanket exception for the disabled, that they should get this winter fuel allowance regardless. But then you come up against, well, some disabled pensioners are millionaires. Some are, no doubt, among the richest people in the country. Should they get the £300? And if not, then where's the cut-off point? 0345 6060 973. Coventry, Frieda.
Hello, young man. I've just got a query about the information that's being given out. 35,000, if you're disabled or whatever, you're likely to not be working. So, therefore, that's what they're getting, I assume, net in their hand, as it were. Somebody who's on 24,000, who's, I don't know, 22 and working, their money, does that take account of all their deductions? Because if they're on 24, they're probably getting 16 in their hand. Mm. So that's just a point that I thought was important to clarify.
Yes. Well, I'm not an expert in this regard, Frieda, but I would imagine that as the phrase is earning 35,000, then that 35,000 would be subject to tax.
Possibly, but not necessarily.
No, quite.
That's why I queried it, the figures.
I mean, Dennis Reid of the over-60s campaign group Silver Voices said the annual income of £35,000 is not a king's ransom under any circumstances. So if that is your income, then the amount over the allowance, which is, I can't quite remember off the top of my head, isn't it?
No,
12,000 or something like that. Then yeah, that would be subject to tax. So that I'm guessing that that is not £35,000 in your hand.
I still think it's questionable, given everything that's been said, because, you know, people on benefits and things get all sorts of add-ons and what have you. For example, their rent paid or their mortgage interest. I don't know the detail, obviously. I'm not an accountant.
Mm.
But I just wonder how accurate that figure is compared to somebody young who's slogging their guts out, for want of a better way of putting it.
Well, I mean, if you get to over 60 then and you're making 35,000, then it would be either through pension or maybe interest on your savings accounts. So that implies that, unless you just got really lucky and were given the money, that you've been slogging your guts out your whole life and, you know, looking forward to putting your feet up for a while.
Well, I understand. I'm in my 70s myself. But my query was, is the 35 grand net or subject to deductions?
Yeah.
And given the way the benefit system seems to work for everybody, or certainly other people, I just wonder, because they get a bit for this, a bit for that, a bit for something else, you know, and then it suddenly tots up to 35 grand. I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, maybe. I mean, is this going to affect you this year? Are you going to be in receipt of this £300?
I honestly don't know. All I do know is that the last time it was awarded, it only went to people on, I forgot what they call it, you know, the...
Universal credit?
No, the other... Oh.
Disability living allowance?
No, it's a top-up thing.
Right.
Where you automatically got it. I've got a friend who gets £3 a week more than me in pension. He got it and I didn't. And I've never worked out why.
Right.
So, you know, you tell me. There's the irony of life.
So did you get this last year? I mean, did you find the bills tough to pay last year?
I found the bill. Yeah, I barely had my heating on at all.
Mm.
You know, I just couldn't do it. You know, it's as simple as that. But, yeah, it's just one of them, isn't it? What can you do?
Yes, as an individual, not much, but, you know, together we are strong, Frieda.
Can I just suggest to you what my favourite saying is these days?
Go on.
Keep my head below the parapets and two fingers in the air.
That's good advice. All right, thanks a lot, Frieda.
Take care.
Ta-da. 0345 6060 973. Nadia in Hastings says, Nick, I am 63, so not a pensioner, but I am disabled. The Tories took our winter fuel about 3 years ago. Nobody said anything. No outcry, no concern, nothing. So I am disabled, get extra cold in the winter in a very cold flat with an income of about £12,000 a year. There's no winter fuel for me or people like me, yet no one is arguing for us on the radio. I don't believe that with an income of £35,000, you need extra winter fuel money. That is a good point, isn't it? I mean, there's people on minimum wage who are earning £24,000 a year, and they would be much less able to pay their winter fuel bills than somebody who has retired and through, you know, great good fortune or a lot of hard work is on significantly more than that. Seems a bit upside down. Just by dint of age is the requirement for this pension. I don't really think that's fair. Steve says, Nick, why doesn't the government make the energy companies pay out? They are earning excessive profits. These companies can reduce or give discounts to the elderly and the disabled people, and it could either be given back via their corporation tax payments or from their government grants. These energy companies are being allowed to force people into poverty. Yeah. So, should those on £35,000 a year get a winter fuel allowance? And it's the up to £35,000, but if you are on that amount, then that means that you get the £300 a year. Do you really need that money if you are earning that amount? And should we make a blanket exception for the disabled? And what if the disabled person is a millionaire? Shouldn't there be some sort of cut-off for the disabled as well? And the government needs to address the black hole, we're told. £50 billion they need to find. So who should pay more tax or who should get less in benefits? Or is there another way that the government could address that black hole? And how did you fare last winter? And are you concerned about the prospect of the next winter? 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850. Email nick@lbc.co.uk. And if you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone. 0345 6060 973. More of your thoughts on this to come, but after the break, we're going to be talking about Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine will continue to fight for its freedom in a defiant address to the nation on its Independence Day. I'll get the latest with a senior defence fellow. Keep calling. I'll come to your calls later on, 0345 6060 973. But for now, the headlines with Tim Daly.
An investigation has begun in Hertfordshire after a man was hit with a petrol bomb while reportedly putting up flags in Stevenage. Police say he suffered a head injury after a glass bottle containing a lit rag was thrown on Saturday lunchtime. A human rights lawyer has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC the government's new push to speed up the appeals process for asylum seekers should begin with improving Home Office decision-making. Around 51,000 cases are believed to be stuck in a backlog, and residents in Gaza City are reporting more strikes from Israeli planes and tanks. They say buildings and homes have been destroyed in eastern and northern outskirts. LBC weather, largely dry with variable cloud overnight. Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland could experience drizzle, and we'll see a low in some places of 14 degrees.
LBC.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/lptv. Offer ends 27th of August.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Train to Peckham, kids in tow, rooftop cinema time.
Six packs of popcorn?
I think one will do, Nina.
Ah, clear skies, comfy seats, a talking panda, clearly what we all needed. Okay, everyone's seated now, happily doing panda impressions. I wonder when Nan can watch the kids so I can come back with James. Oh, just the two of us.
Download the Southern Railway app to book advanced tickets from only £8 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply, see our website for full details.
I'm six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Ever won a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6. T's and C's apply. Subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine would continue to fight for its freedom while its calls for peace are not heard in a defiant address to the nation on Ukraine's Independence Day. Let's talk about the state of the action with Daniel L. Davis. Daniel Davis is a former lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, senior fellow at Defense Priorities, and host of Daniel Davis Deep Dive on YouTube. Good evening, Daniel.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate your time. So what do you know of this state of play as it stands?
Well, I mean, you just mentioned this was the Independence Day for Ukraine, and there was a really defiant and fiery speech by Zelensky saying, we may not have won yet, but we will definitely not lose. And this is what happens when our calls for peace aren't answered, because they talk about some attacks into the Russian Federation. But the bottom line is that the power dynamic still is where it has been, and that is in the Russian side. And there is no power, there is no leverage for either the Ukraine or the Europe and the United States combined to force Russia into any kind of concession that is desirable for the Ukraine side. And as long as that continues on, Russia is going to continue to winning the air war, and they're going to continue to winning the fight on the ground as well. And it's just a matter of time before Russia eventually grinds down the Ukraine, however badly we don't want to see that happen. That's just the military reality.
But if that were a reality, surely that would have happened already. I mean, the war has been going for a lot longer than the 3 or 4 days that Vladimir Putin expected it to take for him to take Kyiv.
He never actually intended to take Kyiv, and that's evident by the number of troops that he had, which was far, far too insufficient to actually take. He did think that that demonstration in February 2022 would cause the Ukraine side to capitulate, and in that he was badly mistaken, and they've been paying for that mistake ever since. But you have to look at the Russian objective is to destroy the Ukrainian armed forces, and that is what they have been doing on the field with the losses that they've been suffering. The Russian side has the capacity, even the manpower, to continue to spend on that objective. And even though they haven't taken the country by now, it has been a nonstop offensive advance. Even if it's slow, it's been consistent for more than 2 years now. And the human losses on the Ukraine side are just stacking up, and they're unsustainable. They can't go along a war of attrition like this, but the Russian side can. That's the ugly truth, I'm afraid.
Overnight, Moscow said that Ukraine had attacked Russian power and energy facilities, a nuclear power plant. What do you know about that?
Yeah, I was reading actually The Guardian about an hour ago, so I saw what the claims are. You never know these things right offhand. Sometimes Russia could say that just to make the Ukraine side look better. But sometimes the Ukraine does that. They do certainly attack things overnight. Zelensky commented on his attacks into the Russian Federation. And, of course, there's return fire every night as well. And the Russians are hitting the Ukraine side back and forth. Bottom line is, because nobody has agreed to any kind of a ceasefire, the war continues on both in the air and on the ground. And these attacks will continue, I think, every day on both sides.
Do you think Ukraine would actually target a nuclear power plant, though?
You know, like I say, I do. I think it is possible. They have done a lot of things that I wouldn't have expected somebody to do, and they've hit targets to try and certainly in some cases, I think, to try and spawn more outrage around the world. Because then, of course, we've seen this in both directions. One side claims something that turns out not to be the case, but they accuse the other side of doing it to try and get public perception on their side, both domestic and international. And right now, I'll just tell you, both sides will do whatever it takes to win the war. And if they thought they could get a benefit from that, then yeah, I think they'd do it.
There was a prisoner swap. Some people might find that a bit surprising, that they can communicate with each other and trust each other to the extent that they can actually negotiate the prisoner swap between Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah, they've been doing that actually for quite some time, and especially with repatriating dead soldiers on each side, too. That's been going on for a long time. And any time you have something that's in the mutual benefit of both, that they can both benefit from it, then they'll cooperate on that. But if it's something that one side thinks that they'll lose and the other side gains, then we haven't seen any movement in that. And certainly that takes into effect that, you know, the Ukraine demand for a 30-day unconditional ceasefire, or Russia's demand that, hey, all you have to do is give up your territory that you haven't lost yet and we'll end the war. Neither side is willing to give in on that one. And that's why we kind of have this diplomatic stalemate.
There's a report that says that the U.S. has been blocking Ukraine from firing long-range missiles into Russian territory for several months now. What do you make of that?
You know, I've seen that report, too. It's not, like so many things, it's not openly confirmed. But that would make sense because, I mean, President Trump is trying to position himself as a mediator and trying to convince Putin to give in to some, you know, give in some things here and Zelensky to give in to some other things there, et cetera. And so it would make sense that Trump wouldn't want to be saying, yeah, and we're going to also support long-range strikes into Russia proper. I feel very confident that those are some of the comments that Putin has been making behind the scenes, either to Trump or to Witkoff, saying, hey, we can talk to you, but if you keep doing this, you know, striking, enabling them to strike in our country with your weapons, it's not going to work out well. And I bet they probably said, hey, we need, you know, some goodwill on your part. And that's a relatively small one, because I'll just tell you, it doesn't make a big difference whether they fire the long range or not. There's not enough of them. And Russia does have the capacity to shoot down a pretty solid portion of those. Some will get through. But as Zelensky actually said today, when asked that very question, he said, well, I don't need the American stuff. I've got my own stuff. And that's what we've been launching deep into Russia and having some success.
What do you make of Donald Trump's actions in this regard?
You know, I tell you, it's not that great, because you never know where he stands. I mean, he came in saying I'm going to solve it in 24 hours because I know Putin and I know Zelensky and we'll figure this out. It won't even be hard. I think I remember him even telling a British presenter in 2023 that very thing. And then, of course, it got into office and it turned into 100 days. And then in April, he said, all right, well, we're days away from walking away if we don't get this solved. And then it turned into those days passed, and then it turned into 50 days, and then it was 10 days. We need an unconditional ceasefire, or there's going to be bone-crushing sanctions. The 10 days expired. There were no sanctions. Now then, they're just saying, all right, forget about the ceasefire. Let's try to get negotiations. So he's all over the map. And then yesterday, he says again, well, within a couple of weeks, we'll know, and then maybe I'm going to do sanctions. Honestly, I don't think anybody can take the president at his word right now, because no one knows where he's going to be on a given day, and that's just not helpful trying to negotiate an end of war terms.
Do you think that Vladimir Putin is actually playing him?
I think everybody's playing him. I think the European Union, the European leaders are playing, trying to influence Trump. Zelensky is definitely trying to influence Trump, and yes, for sure, Putin is trying to influence Trump as well, with that really strange picture he sent to him that Trump showed in the Oval Office on Friday, I think. So, yeah, he's definitely trying to do that.
Donald Trump seems to be enamored of Vladimir Putin. Is that fair to say?
I think it is fair to say. He is, you know, the leader of the world's largest nuclear weapons country, and we have to have good relations with him. So I think it's appropriate that he has relations and tries to have amicable relations so we don't get into some kind of a stupid war. But yeah, sometimes it does seem a little bit on the side of enamored, I would say.
What did you make of the Alaska summit?
I thought it was a good thing that he's talking, because look, the previous administration wouldn't even talk to Russia on an official level. And if you're not talking, you don't even have a chance to find an end to the war. At least Trump is trying to do that, so I give him props on that. But again, you've got to have a consistent position, and it's got to be something that's realistic that you can maybe ooch each side along. Because if you don't have something that's accomplishable or attainable, then you're literally just talking to the wind. And I'm not sure that we're in a better place, but at least they're talking. And as long as they're talking, there's hope for the future. But it's with an asterisk, I guess I can say.
What do you make of the sort of optics of it? Because before the head-to-head with Trump and Putin, they were all grinning and, you know, thumbs up, or Trump was. And he came out a couple of hours later looking like he'd seen a ghost. What do you think happened in there?
I'm afraid I'm actually not familiar with what photograph you're talking about, so I really couldn't comment on that one, I'm afraid.
Well, okay, they went in all happy, and they came out, and the entire Trump team looked as though they'd been used as a punch bag. It was really really stark. What do you think of the UK troops as a peacekeeping force?
You know, oddly enough, that's one area where Russia didn't just automatically say no. They said, yeah, I think it's possible for peacekeeping troops as long as they're from all members of the UNSC, the United Nations Security Council, permanent members. So that would be British, French, and then the Americans and Chinese and Russian. So he was the Russians are going, yeah, sure, they can come as long as all the other ones are there, too, which are ours. And, of course, everybody in the West is saying, you know, that's a non-starter. But I think that's Russia's way of saying, and it's a non-starter for us to have NATO troops as part of any kind of peacekeeping, because they're actually participants in the war and helping Ukraine fight against us and kill our troops. So, you know, you have to look at this from both sides, even if you hate the other side, to understand where they're coming from, or you can't get to any common ground. And so that's an issue right now that I don't see a solution to from either side giving in.
You mentioned Steve Witkoff. He talked of a NATO Article 5 style security guarantee. What do you think he meant by that?
Yeah, it is. And everything gets down to definitions, because what it seems like people are talking about, and what Russia said afterwards, because Witkoff said this was in their discussion, his discussion with Putin on the Wednesday before the Alaska meeting. And when you look at what the Russians are saying and what even Witkoff is implying, is that an Article 5 top, in the sense that if a nation is attacked, then the participant nations, whoever they may be, whoever would sign on to that document, would then consult with Ukraine, and then they will go back to their own parliaments and decide what they're going to do as a result. It's not any kind of an automatic trigger for going in and fighting, as incidentally, neither is the NATO Article 5. It also has that same kind of language in it. So it sounds more like a consultative thing, but they're calling it security guarantees, because I'm just telling you, I can't see any way that either Britain or France or Germany is going to willingly go fight Russia in the future when they won't do it now. So I honestly doubt anyone is going to go beyond words on talking about security guarantees for Ukraine.
Suppose in the best circumstance, there was a ceasefire called and Ukraine agreed to give up the territory that Russia has already acquired. Do you think that that would be the end of it, or would it just be a springboard for Russia to recoup and then relaunch attacks in the future?
Well, see, I doubt from the Russian side that that would be sufficient, because they have been continuing to say it's not just the territory, but it's what they call denazification. That was part of their Istanbul 2022 terms that they were working on. It was also in their Istanbul meeting a couple of months ago or so, or the second Istanbul meeting that they just had. They keep saying that. So I don't know that Russia would agree to it, even if they got the territory and the ceasefire. Now, they may, if there was, apparently they might sequence them. So if the Ukraine side withdrew from the Donbass, apparently, then Russia may go to a ceasefire to work on the rest. But in terms of an end of war, I don't think they would do it unless they got the demilitarization and some version of denazification that could be acceptable. And I just don't see Ukraine agreeing to anything like that. And the danger of that is that that leaves the matter on the battlefield, and eventually Ukraine will probably succumb. So that's the real danger.
Very good to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time. That's Daniel L. Davis, former Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army, Senior Fellow at Defense Priorities, and the host of Daniel Davis Deep Dive on YouTube. Now, we're going to take a short break and then come back with your thoughts about the new policy around winter fuel allowance. You remember last winter it was quite the talking point. And Keir Starmer is now has a new policy in that regard. The decision is to restrict the payment to those earning £35,000 or less. But that does mean that it will, the cut-off point will hit around 600,000 disabled pensioners who are now not going to get that money. Do you think it's fair enough if you're earning £35,000? Should an exception be made? And just generally, what about those who aren't pensioners who are earning, say, minimum wage? Shouldn't they be given £300 as a winter fuel allowance? 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Thames Valley Police and Crime Commissioner Matthew Barber saying people should intervene to stop criminals escaping. Atul Patel runs St George's Pharmacy in London.
Basically just walk in and they'll swipe the shelf and go. The police, they're not interested at all.
Cars in Sutton.
You see it all the time. They've got no fear whatsoever.
I don't think I want to live in a country where holding a poster saying I oppose genocide means you get arrested. Isn't that an overreach?
Labour MP and Policing Minister Dame Diana Johnson.
Sadly, the one-in-one-out deal doesn't seem to be working since that was announced last month. Numbers have gone up 50%. Well, this is an utter failure.
We've got a whole range of other measures we're bringing in, but because of the weather conditions...
Okay. Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back Tuesday morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
Pump 6 in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Ever won a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6. T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Combine your pensions with PensionBee and take control of your retirement. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
Summer's nearly over. It's time to get back to real life. Luckily, Sinch has got all the essentials sorted. And we're not talking about new textbooks. Let's see. The biggest range of cars to buy entirely online? Check. Free 90-day warranty? Sorted. And fat-free Sinch servicing at a Marshall store near you? Absolutely cinched it. Everything you need and not a pencil case in sight. Cinch it for yourself today. Visit cinch.co.uk. Comparison against equivalent retailers. Visit cinch.co.uk/range claim. Terms and exclusions apply.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It's the second winter in a row. Well, it's not winter yet, but it shortly will be, that we are talking about the winter fuel allowance. And the Prime Minister's decision is to restrict that payment this time around to those earning £35,000 or less. That is after the row that he suffered last year. Do you think that that's fair enough? Stourbridge. Hello, Sally.
Hi, Nick. All right.
Yeah, good, thanks.
I thought I'd put my 2 pence worth in here because I'm a disabled pensioner. And I'm a bit of a weird hybrid because I'm a baby boomer. So free tuition, paid off my mortgage, comfortable occupational pension. So pretty comfortable. I don't really need the winter fuel allowance. But I did wonder, £35,000, that's really high. I wonder if I actually sort of creep in under that. And I probably would because I'm on PIP. And that's quite a big super lump of money, to be honest. Pays for my car and I get a bit of extra allowance for care as well. But it seems that no disability benefits are counted as earned income. So none of that counts towards that £35,000. So a lot of disabled pensioners are still going to get it. It's still going to be only those not rolling, you know, running it in that are getting it. So your premise that a lot of people are going to be lose out again, I don't think that's actually going to be the case. Certainly it isn't with me. I mean, I'm a left-leaning Labour supporter. I've got a huge bang in the wall where I keep banging my head in it as they zoom from one side to the other. So please, no, just can we think things through a bit? And I just think this is ridiculously high. I really do. And there are lots of other people. I mean, I'll give it. I'm not giving it back. I'm not that generous. But I will give it to my daughter and her husband and their two little girls who were struggling all the time. And, you know, they're on...
That is a good point, though, isn't it? I mean, there's people that are living in complete poverty who will get none of this. They won't get the winter fuel allowance at all. And those who are living a life of comparative luxury, as you've just described yourself, who will get it? It doesn't really seem fair.
Well, hold on, not luxury. Don't go too mad.
No, okay. I've gone too far. Yeah. Well, you're comfortable. Would that
I'm
be fair?
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely comfortable, apart from I've suddenly got a huge bill for my teeth. Now, if they started giving us some allowances towards our heavy dental bills, now you'd be talking.
Mm. Well, give us an idea of how much PIP is worth.
Oh, God, it's difficult to work it out because you're given it and then it's taken away again.
How do you mean?
If you have a car, then that's all taken away. You do have to pay something towards it when you first have it. And because I have a wheelchair, I had to pay another £600 for a boot hoist. There's all these stupid... I'm about to pay for my wheelchair and the scooter and all those. So there's all those little things. And then you get, that's £300 a month, which is, you know, it's no... I mean, it's £300 a month, not a year.
Hmm.
And that goes towards all those extra things. Okay, yes, I'm at home all day long, so, you know, I do have the heating on all day long in the winter. So those are the things that do bump it up. But if that's not counting towards the 35K, then I'm well under that. I will get my 200 or the kids will anyway. So,
and did you get it last year?
No.
Right.
Well, nobody did, did they?
Yeah.
No, because I'm not remotely near pension credit.
Right.
Because, as I say, the lucky little baby boomer me.
You had the foresight to get born at the right time.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. I was a waspy woman. I did lose just a little bit, but you know, because I had an occupational pension, that wasn't the end of the world. I do think people did miss out on that, some people.
Right.
But it's always some people do, some people don't.
That's right. Good to talk to you, Sally. Thanks for that.
Okay.
0345 6060 973. David says, it's the worst state pension in Western Europe. No other country has this corrupt public debate over the affordability or whether the state pension should be means-tested. It's a total disgrace. That is true. We do have the worst state pension in Western Europe, but it's a bit difficult comparing directly between countries because you get, in this country, certain things that you don't get in other countries. Now, whether that makes up for it, I don't know. I mean, the big one, of course, is free at the point of use health service, which is unique pretty much to this country. So the sort of the private pension, the private health care that you would have to shell out at least a certain amount for, you know, the insurance and then there's top-ups and so on, in other countries is might, or in this country, yeah, in other countries might actually make up the difference. But it's a bit difficult to compare directly. But it is true, we do have the worst state pension in Western Europe. Market Drayton, Georgia.
Yes, how are you?
Good, thanks, Georgie.
This is a bit of a bugbear that's on my mind every time I hear these things going on. If you're in the Lords, daily, you get nearly £400. Now, I don't know if there are subsidies of food and drink.
Oh, there are. Oh, yes.
Well, I believed there were, but I wasn't sure. And there was one person who used to come to the Lords in the taxi, go and sign in, have a drink, go back to his taxi, and go home.
Yeah.
And he was getting nearly four. I mean, he was found out.
I'm sure that happens quite a lot. I mean, it is probably the world's best club. They pay you to go there.
Yes. And they're not going to be people who actually need money. Once you're in the Lords, it's a real bugbear with me every time I think about it. You know, for one day, they could pay four people's heating allowance. If they want to give up one, I don't know. It's just, I'm so frustrated by it.
Well, that's a very good point. It would take one day, and they would pay more than one person's heating allowance for an entire year. And, of course, and this is going to upset you even more, I suspect, Georgie, they get paid tax-free.
They don't. Oh, my gosh. I don't know why I'm surprised. I mean,
and
I'm 88, and I tell you, this world, I feel so sorry for the generations coming up, because it's a really awful, awful world we're in. And
it doesn't seem to be getting better, not at the moment. I mean, maybe that will change in a short while. We'll find out when we get there. But things don't seem to be on the up at the moment, generally speaking.
Yeah, I was a child of the war. I mean, I was a child that used to jump over bombed buildings when I was about 8 or 9 and have wonderful fun, and things were rationed and you couldn't get through. I had so much better life than the poor kids have today, I tell you.
And that says quite a lot, yes. Georgie, good to talk to you. Thanks for that. I'm going to change it up after the news. Angela Rayner is what we're going to be talking about. Angela Rayner has somehow managed to trigger the Conservatives by buying a second house. The Deputy Prime Minister has bought a £700,000 seaside apartment in upmarket Hove. But do you think that she has done anything wrong? Is this a good look for the housing minister? And why don't people like the working class Labour politician? Call me now, 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. A man's been hit in the face with a petrol bomb while reportedly putting up flags in Hertfordshire. Police in Stevenage say he was struck by a glass bottle containing a lit rag on Saturday, as LBC's Joe Hawkins now reports.
It's believed the injured man is in his 30s and suffered a cut to the head after being hurt on Saturday lunchtime. Hertfordshire police say he was then taken to Lister Hospital in Stevenage for treatment. Online, a group calling itself Stevenage Patriots has said on X it was hanging St George's flags on lampposts and poles for around 3 hours when the attack happened. Police say they're investigating a contained incident and are now trying to reassure the local community.
A human rights lawyer has been telling LBC the government's new push to speed up the appeals process for asylum seekers should actually begin with improving decision-making at the Home Office. Around 51,000 cases are believed to be stuck in a backlog. It typically takes around a year for conclusions to be reached on individual appeals. Protests have been continuing over the use of hotels to house asylum seekers. Demonstrators have been gathering at Castle Bromwich in the West Midlands, Epping in Essex, and Canary Wharf in London. Dozens wrapped in the flag of St George also turned out in Norwich.
The local people, they're scared to go to the park because they're getting followed.
Like Norfolk and Suffolk are my local areas, and I feel if Norfolk's affected by it, then I can't just sit on the sofa and do nothing.
If we left it now, we've failed our children. We've failed our women. We've failed everyone else. We'll stay here till every one of these are moved out.
The death toll in Yemen following Israeli strikes has now risen to at least 6. A Houthi health official says 86 people were wounded because of the attacks on sites, including a military compound housing the presidential palace. On Friday, the Iranian-backed Houthis said they had fired a ballistic missile towards Israel. A series of nationwide walkouts by bus drivers is being threatened because of disputes over pay and conditions. Around 7,500 members of Unite are either striking or balloting on industrial action in areas areas around England and Wales. The union says abuse, assaults and fatigue are a daily occurrence for its members. LBC weather, largely dry with variable cloud overnight. There could be some drizzle in Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland with a low of 14. Dry, warm and sunny for much of the UK during Monday. Northern Ireland could see some outbreaks of rain later in the day and there'll be a high of 28 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Times reports that Angela Rayner has purchased a seaside apartment on the south coast of England for more than £700,000, meaning the Deputy Prime Minister occupies three properties. Let's talk about this with Kevin Schofield. Kevin is the political editor at HuffPost UK, who has written the article, Angela Rayner has managed to trigger the Tories by buying a house. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks. Well, the coverage of this implies that Rachel Reeves has three homes. Does she?
Well, Angela Rayner has two homes that she's bought. She has one in Ashton-under-Lyne, up where she's the MP. She's got the second one near Brighton that she bought earlier this year, and the third one, she doesn't own it. It is Admiralty House, which is the grace and favour property that comes with the job, in her case, as Deputy Prime Minister. So that isn't, she doesn't pay for that. So that, I don't think you could say that that is her house, that, that belongs to the Cabinet Office, really. It's not, she certainly doesn't own it. I mean, I've seen today talking about her having a property empire. I mean, that's just so over the top. She's got two houses, which, you know, to most people, that is a lot. Obviously, most people have only got one. But to call it an empire, I think, is a little bit over the top.
Yeah. I mean, do you think Labour get judged by different metrics on this kind of thing?
Undoubtedly. And Angela Rayner, in particular, she gets a really hard time from a lot of the right-wing press. If you remember, she got a hard time for going to the opera, as if, you know, someone from her background is getting maybe ideas above their station. I think definitely, I mean, Conservative MPs, countless Conservative MPs, former cabinet ministers, front benchers have multiple houses. They do have property empires, but you don't see anything in the newspapers about that, because that's almost like, well, that kind of comes with the territory, maybe for Conservatives. But Angela Rayner in particular, and Labour MPs, but particularly Angela Rayner, for some reason she gets under the skin of an awful lot of people on the right of British politics, and she undoubtedly gets, I think, judged by a different standard than everyone else.
Yeah, it's a class thing, isn't it? It's just fine for a toff Tory to have a stately home like Rees-Mogg, but not fine for an uppity commoner like Rachel Reeves to get above a station and be so presumptuous as to have two homes.
Yeah, it really is bizarre. I mean, I saw it in the front of a couple of papers this morning. The Sun on Sunday had it on the front, and the Mail on Sunday exclusive. And I thought, my goodness, this must be a big scandal. So I carefully read the articles, and I couldn't see anything that Angela Rayner had actually done wrong. And I contacted her, her people to find out what they were saying. And they were just pointing out that, you know, she has to spend an awful lot of time over the last 10 years as an MP, spent an awful lot of time in and around London. She thought it would be good to have a second property, which she's paid for herself, in the south of England, which is what she's done with this house near Brighton. But there's no suggestion that she's dodged tax or that she's not paying what she's supposed to pay in terms of stamp duty, council tax, all that type of thing. So, you know, I don't think there is a scandal here at all.
Yeah, and yet, there doesn't really have to be a scandal for it to appear as though there is a scandal, depending on how the papers write it up. And they do concentrate on this £700,000 number. Now, Hove is a pretty flash place, and I'm sure you don't get a lot for your money for 700 grand. And her other property she bought for 375,000, so that's just over £1 million, which I very much doubt would buy the kitchen in one of Rishi Sunak's Kensington Mews homes. He's got a ramshackle mansion in Yorkshire. He's got another flat in Kensington and a £5.5 million penthouse overlooking the sea in California. I don't remember reading many articles of outrage about that.
No, exactly. Certainly not outrage. I mean, people would refer to him being wealthy, but it certainly wasn't seen as him getting above his station in the same way that it does with Angela Rayner, as if there was something wrong with him, if he can afford it, paying buying properties of obviously very expensive properties. But for whatever reason, Angela Rayner, I think because of her background, people just think, you know, there's something dodgy here. Why, how can someone who came from a working class background like her on an MP's salary, albeit with a ministerial salary on top now, how can she possibly afford it? Well, I'm sure she can. I'm sure there's nothing dodgy about it. And as I say, her people, I've stressed that everything is done above board. So yeah, I think it's just a case of her being judged by a different standard from other MPs.
And you seem to imply that it was her specifically rather than Labour MPs in general.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, you know, if you think back to that story about her going to the opera as if that was some big scandal, there was also a story, if you remember, about her dancing in the DJ booth in Ibiza.
Yeah.
She got criticised for that. There was a picture in the paper last week of her in Hove near Brighton having a glass of wine on the beach. There was another wearing a dry robe. There was a picture of her, I think she must be on holiday right now, vaping in a canoe. And it's just, you know, it's the type of thing that for some reason she just attracts the interest of particularly the right of the media. Are fascinated by what she does. In many ways, I think, and she wouldn't thank me for this comparison, in many ways she's a bit like the Boris Johnson of the left. You know, the way that whatever Boris Johnson did used to really wind up lots of people on the left of politics. It's the same, but the shoe's on the other foot for Angela Rayner. Whatever she does, it seems to wind up a lot of people on the right.
And hypocrisy is one of the charges that's been thrown at her, but that seems a bit desperate, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, again, I just don't get this hypocrisy charge. If she had said, I will make it the policy, or my policy, that no one should have a second home, and then went out and bought a second home, that would obviously be hypocrisy. But as far as I'm aware, that's not the government's position. Now, they have talked about increasing council tax on second homeowners. Fair enough, they're entitled to do that if they wish. As long as she's paying that extra council tax, then I don't see what the problem is. If she feels that she needs to have a home paid for by herself in the south of the country and can afford it and pays everything that she's supposed to pay in order to buy it and run it, then I don't see the problem. So I really don't see what the hypocrisy angle is there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it doesn't matter if there is hypocrisy there, as long as they imply with a nod and a wink that there is without actually saying it out loud. I mean, it would make more sense if she was using a loophole to avoid some tax or law, but her government's own actions have made it more expensive for her to own two homes.
Yeah, exactly. And listen, if she had used some sort of loophole and was being hypocritical, I would be the first to criticise her. But I think it's just the way that this story's been presented is trying to turn it into a scandal that it absolutely isn't.
And the government have introduced some good measures to help renters. They've cut red tape to make more mortgages available to first-time buyers. They've pledged to build 1.5 million new homes in 4 years, which is about the same as the Tories managed in 10 years. And yet Labour get absolutely no credit for any of this.
No, well, I guess the proof of the pudding obviously will be in the eating on the 1.5 million homes pledge. That's 300,000 a year, which I think was run about what the Tories were promising and never managed. Now, obviously, that's Angela Rayner's department. The pressure is on her to meet that pledge. But again, that is a separate issue. There was one person, a few people actually last night on the right were trying to tie it into the immigration story, saying, well, Labour or Angela Rayner has said that asylum seekers should be housed around the country, to spread it around. Why isn't she letting an asylum seeker sleep in her house? And I just thought, I mean, what on earth? I mean, she's not said people should open their doors to asylum seekers. No, that is not what she said. She said, as I just explained, you know, in any available accommodation, if it's vacant, then perhaps that could be made available for asylum seekers. But people trying to tie that in as another stick to beat Angela Rayner with, it's all a bit crazy, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, whatever the reasons, and despite the extra tax that she will be paying, council and stamp duty, as housing minister in charge of addressing the nation's lack of housing, it's not a good look, is it?
No, I mean, I do accept that. I do see it may look like she is sort of hoarding extra accommodation that maybe she shouldn't be if she's looking for housing to be made available to people looking to rent. That is maybe a justifiable criticism, but I don't think it warrants the level of criticism that that she's had in the newspapers this morning.
But do you get that the party in general, the current government, is a bit politically naive, almost as though they weren't ready for governing?
Yeah, I think some of the decisions that they've made have been pretty silly. I mean, you've only got to think back to the winter fuel debacle. You know, that was a bizarre political decision. How they never war gamed that to appreciate that would actually go down pretty badly with the general public. So yeah, absolutely. Listen, there's been numerous own goals really by the government in the last year. But I don't think this is one of them. I don't think it ranks quite up there with other mistakes that they've made since last year's general election.
And being the political editor at HuffPost, I mean, you will be privy to all sorts of press releases and so on. You'll be in the conduit of information that comes from Number 10. How does it compare to previous governments?
I mean, I think, in fairness, they could probably be better, but I think all journalists would say that. We all want more information, and Number 10, regardless of whatever political colour, they'll be happy to give you certain bits of information, but others they will obviously want to keep under wraps. I don't think they're by no means the worst. I got on with a few sort of decent sources within Number 10, have been very helpful to me, but by the same token, previous administrations I've got on well with other communications professionals under the Conservatives as well. So I don't think they're much worse. I don't think they're any worse, actually, and not that much better than others. I think by and large, they're all much of a muchness. We would like them to be a little bit more open than they are, but obviously it's in their interest to try and limit how much information we can get our hands on.
Yeah, do you think that the game has changed relatively recently? That some of the more high-profile politicians, I'm thinking of Farage and Jenrick particularly, they've sort of skipped around the mainstream media and done a sort of and Trump-style, appealed directly to the public through social media. Do you think that the government is sort of lacking on that score?
I think they're definitely trailing behind Nigel Farage. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he's got a huge following on TikTok, for instance. I'm not even sure Keir Starmer is on TikTok. I'm pretty sure if he is, he won't be having anywhere near the following that Nigel Farage does. I think, yeah, they've maybe missed a trick there. So, yeah, maybe that their social media output could improve. I mean, Robert Jenrick, he's very good at it as well, very slick, very professional videos that he puts out. Unfortunately, he seems to have inspired a trend amongst other MPs, these sort of walkie-talkie videos that they do. They're talking straight into the camera while walking down the street. Now they're all jumping on that bandwagon. He, to be fair, does it very well indeed. Keir Starmer, that's just not his bag, is it? So yeah, I think they are probably, they could sharpen up their output and on social media as well.
If you had to make a guess, do you think that Keir Starmer would stay in position until the next election?
If you'd asked me after the election, I would have said 100%, you know, just won a landslide, he's safe as houses. I think I wouldn't really put my mortgage on it now. I wouldn't put Angela Rayner's mortgage on it either. It's not a done deal. I think the elections, local elections in May next year will be fascinating. If Labour do badly in the council elections in England and in the Welsh election and in the Scottish election, I think he could be in a little bit of bother, especially if they don't improve in the opinion polls. I think, on balance, he probably will be. Labour, historically, aren't very good at getting rid of unpopular leaders. You think Gordon Brown, Jeremy Corbyn. But there's no doubt at all that he's under pressure to improve the government's standing in the opinion polls and their election performances as well.
Very good to talk to you, Kevin. Thanks very much for that. That's Kevin Schofield, political editor at HuffPost UK, who wrote the article, Angela Rayner has managed to trigger the Tories by buying a house. And she has. What do you think about the press's treatment of Angela Rayner? I mean, do they treat her worse than other politicians? Do they treat her as badly for having three? Well, she doesn't actually have three homes. She has one as the previous Tory incumbent had that Grace and Favour apartment. They had it too. So she's got two homes, which is fairly normal for an MP. I mean, they usually have a home in their constituency and another home in London that they either may own or they may rent. And they don't make a big deal about it when anybody else has it, and particularly when Tories have it. I mean, Rees-Mogg, the papers are absolutely delighting in, you know, looking inside his sprawling mansion. And by the way, just as a point of order, I did describe Rishi Sunak's house as ramshackle, which it absolutely isn't. Rambling was what I was actually going for, as in old and large and of many rooms. Not ramshackle, rambling. So, what do you make of this new row about Angela Rayner? It's almost as though she can't do anything without upsetting the usual suspects. And just on the point of her being the housing minister, maybe it's politically naive to be buying a second home in an upmarket seaside resort. What do you think? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
Right. Any chance you could give me a hand with dinner?
Sure. Think you can manage after Dad totally smashed it last night?
Of course. I've got a HelloFresh dinner coming up, so watch out.
Wow, this is good. We're on a roll this week.
HelloFresh brings the inspiration back to dinner time. Fresh ingredients, tasty recipes, and no more staring blankly into the fridge. HelloFresh. Nothing beats dinner time. Hello.
There are days when you're hungry for McDonald's. Then there are days when you're big arch hungry for McDonald's. You'll get to know the difference. New Big Arch for Big McDonald's Hunger. Until 9th of September, from 11 a.m, participating restaurants only, subject to availability.
Get a step closer to winning a huge £20,000. Enter now at winplus.co.uk. Win Plus, great prizes, real winners. 18 plus, GB only, T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We are talking about Angela Rayner. I was just talking to Kevin Schofield, and he writes for Huffington Post UK, and he wrote the following. Angela Rayner has somehow managed to trigger the Conservatives by buying a house. The Deputy Prime Minister paid more than £700,000 for a seafront property near Brighton. It has become the second home that she owns, as she also has a house in Ashton-under-Lyne in her constituency. As Deputy PM, she also has the use of her Grace and Favour property in Admiralty House. There is no suggestion at all that Rayner, who is from a working-class background and grew up in poverty, has broken any rules. But despite seemingly being in favour of aspiration and home ownership, the Tories have gone into a meltdown over this story. And that's fair to say that they have indeed done just that. What do you think of this? Liverpool, Samantha.
Hello there.
Hello there.
I'm just ringing to say how much I admire Angela Rayner. I mean, what a remarkable woman. She's gone from being a single young mum and working in care homes, I think she did for a while, to being the Deputy Prime Minister. My God. You know, this woman is remarkable. She's outstanding. And I just hate the way the toffs in the media just go for this working class northern woman. How dare she? You know, how dare she be such a success?
It is kind of like that. If you weren't born to wealth, there is a certain element that really resents you getting above your station.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's not part of their tribe, and they don't like it. And the likes of Rees-Mogg, I mean, whose tribe does he belong to? He's one on his own, thank God.
Yes.
So, anyway, I just wanted to say she's amazing, and she should be admired, not vilified.
All right, good to talk to you, Samantha. Thanks for that. This says, in 2023, The Guardian reported that Rishi Sunak's new private heated swimming pool used so much energy that the local electricity network had to be upgraded to meet its power demand. He paid for it, but still. And not to mention, he decided to buy Moderna vaccines when he was Chancellor while having shares in the company. decided to buy Moderna. Oh, you mean the government buy Moderna vaccines? Right, well, I'm sure that nothing untoward happened in any way, shape or form. Andrea says, I believe it's because she is a working class woman, with woman in capital letters and an exclamation mark on the end. Yep, you might have something there. Richmond, Angela.
Hello, Nick.
Angela.
I find Angela Rayner totally inspiring. But not just Angela Rayner. Emily Thornberry, Dawn Butler, Rachel Reeves, Yvette Cooper. You know, the list goes on and on. These women are all phenomenal. And it's the right wing, the Tory press, the Daily Mail and all the rest of it who want to vilify her and put her down. She is just an absolute breath of fresh air.
And do you think that it is not just because she's working class, but because she is specifically a working class woman?
No, I think because when she's in the Houses of Parliament and when she's in Parliament, she gives as good as she gets. When she stood up to, I can't remember who her opposite was at the time, but when she was Deputy Shadow Minister, whoever was standing up against her, I think there were a few of them, she gave as good as she got, and she walked away absolutely proud of what she did, and so she should have been.
No, my question was, you probably misunderstood me. My question was, do you think that she gets the sort of criticism that she does because she is not just working class, but a working class woman?
No.
Okay.
No, Nick.
All right.
I go back to what I said earlier.
All right.
Because the people who she's standing up against in Parliament are the ones with the connections to the press. So it is, I don't like using these words, but it is a witch hunt because she's spooking them. She's frightening them. She's getting them on the run because she's not the normal stereotype of a working class person. And even if there are some parallels or some stereotypes with her, she has the confidence to say, well, that's not my problem, that's your problem.
Yeah, okay, all right, good to talk to you, Angela, thanks for that. Archie in Inverness says, I've got nothing against Angela Rayner, but as I understand it, she claims to be a socialist. There lies the hypocrisy. I don't know. I don't know if she has actually said that she is a socialist, but I mean, you don't have to be a socialist to be a member of the Labour Party or the Labour government. I mean, some would say that this current Labour government is about as far away from socialism as you can get. I think if there is not necessarily hypocrisy, if there's like a political misstep here or a certain naivety, is that she is not only the Deputy Prime Minister, but she's also the Housing Secretary. And she now has two homes of her own and lives in a third. Now, if a Tory did that, the press would not even raise an eyebrow. But the Labour Party do get, to my eyes, judged by different standards. So maybe she should have expected that. Cheadle, Elliot.
Howdy, Nick. Are you okay?
Yes, good, thanks.
Yeah, good. Well, listen, in a country that is reported to be on the verge of requiring a loan from the IMF, a country who is desperately in need of £50 billion to balance the books, people can't pay the electricity bills, the NHS is tiltering on the brink, the water industry is also virtually submerged. And this public officer, this Labour minister, is about to buy an £800,000 holiday home in the informal, is utterly despicable.
Why? Why does the one have anything to do with the other?
To be honest, Nick, I don't care what gender she is. It's irrelevant. It's extraneous. You create the impression that men who ring up about a female making money and buying things is something to do with our bias towards males. It's got nothing to do with that. She is a public officer. She is a Labour minister. She should show a good example. We are in financial ruin at the moment.
But why does her actions actually affect the finances of the nation?
It doesn't affect the finances of the nation. It shows a very bad attitude to the position that the country is in.
In what way?
Well, she should be showing us an example of good restraint, financial restraint.
But restraint in what manner? It's her money. What difference is it? If she's spending it, then, you know, that's that money swirling about the economy in a virtuous circle.
Do you think the British public can really believe that? They see a female who has earned money, and she's earned it perfectly reasonably, but she is spending it frivolously, because she'll be her fourth home, frivolously on a holiday at home in Cornwall, in a time when our country is on its knees.
Well, I'm unfamiliar with that story. I thought you were referring to the house that she, or the flat that she just bought in Hove, the Cornwall thing. Where did you get that from?
Well, she's got four homes. She's got one in Brighton. She's got one in Manchester. She's now got a home, actually, which she's entitled to use, but because of her position in government. Yeah. And now she's got this home in Cornwall that she's
on the Which home in Cornwall? Where did you get this story? I'm unfamiliar with this.
Well, I'm sorry. Maybe it's Brighton. I don't really know. I don't think it matters where it is.
Well, it does, because it's three. It's three. Wait a minute. It's three homes, two of which she owns. One of which is the grace and favour flat that comes with the job. The Tory incumbents, when they were in power, they had the same deal. So there's only two homes.
But I don't care whether she's a Tory or a socialist. It's irrelevant. I don't care what gender she is. I just believe that the intrinsic problem is that she shows no financial restraint in a time when our country is economically...
But what should she do with the money?
That's up to her. I don't care what she does with the money.
No, you absolutely do care what she does with the money. You've just been hyperventilating about it for the last few minutes. But I very much doubt that we're going to get to the bottom of your displeasure, Elliot. So I appreciate it. I'm going to have to move on. Carnforth. Hello, Annie. We've only got about a minute, I'm afraid.
All right. Well, just quickly. The press do go for Angela Rayner. I think it's partly because she's a working class woman, and definitely because she's a working class woman as opposed to a working class man.
I think so.
Who has got the temerity to do really well, having, you know, left school at 16, not having the right education, in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff. So they always go for her. Having said that, I don't think it's a particular good look for the housing minister in a Labour government, which is meant to be the party of the people, although it absolutely isn't at the minute. With Keir Starmer and all that bunch, we really need getting rid of. But, I mean, not Angela Rayner particularly, but it's not a good look, really, when we've got, you know, so many people that just cannot afford even to rent a home, never mind buy one home, you know, and we've got so many people living in temporary accommodation, you know, families living in one room in really bad conditions and stuff because councils haven't got anywhere to house them. So just, you know, for her to have an extra home, it's not a good look. I mean, personally, for me anyway, I don't agree with anybody having a second home because there's so many people who don't have a first one, and it causes problems in places like seaside towns and the Lake District, you name it. Young people cannot ever even dream of renting a home in the Lake District. I've got a carer who comes from Langdale in the Lake District. She's living in Morecambe, which is a very poor seaside town, because she couldn't even afford to rent in the Lake District, so she's working down here. Mm. You know, it causes problems in particularly in tourist places.
I totally get what you're saying, and I agree to a certain extent. She hasn't done anything wrong. There's nothing illegal.
Wrong, no.
She hasn't you know, abused any loopholes. She's not avoiding tax or anything like that.
No.
And it's her money, and she's perfectly entitled to spend it as she does, as she wants. But being housing secretary, it's not a good look. But I wonder if this would be even a story, whether we'd even be talking about it, if it was a Tory housing secretary had done the exact same thing under a Conservative government. My thought is probably not. Good to talk to you, Annie. Thanks for that. Now, we're going to take a break for the news. In the next half hour, we're going to be dropping in to have a chat with our US correspondent. But first, quite alarming statistic. 70% of UK consumers have received a scam message that appeared to come from a trusted source like a delivery company or a bank or a government body. An alarming number of those 70% who've received their scam message have actually lost money because of it. We're going to be talking about that with LBC's technology correspondent Will Guyatt. But first, just past 12:30, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
A man's been hit in the face with a petrol bomb while reportedly putting up flags in Hertfordshire. Police in Stevenage say he was struck by a glass bottle containing a lit rag on Saturday. Protests have been continuing over the use of hotels to house asylum seekers. Demonstrators have been gathering in the West Midlands, Essex, Norfolk and at Canary Wharf in London. And the death toll in Yemen following Israeli strikes has now risen to at least six. A Houthi health official also says 86 people were wounded because of the attacks. LBC weather largely dry with variable cloud overnight. Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland could end up seeing some drizzle, and there'll be a low of around 14 degrees.
LBC.
If I need an eye test, I don't go to Specsavers.
One thing you won't see at Specsavers is me.
Do I go?
Yes!
I mean, no.
Me? I don't go to Specsavers. Nor you, eh, Spike?
Should have gone to Specsavers. Nah.
Hi, Specsavers. Here for your eye test.
They come to me instead.
Come in. Kettle's on.
Oh, thank you.
If you can't go to Specsavers unaccompanied, we could come to you. See if you're eligible at specsavers.co.uk/home visits.
When you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable, and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling, and the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
70% of UK consumers have received a scam message that appeared to come from a trusted source. More than half of those targeted believe that the attempt used artificial intelligence, and almost 10% have lost money to scams. Let's talk about this with Will Guyatt. Will is LBC's technology correspondent. Hi, Will.
Hi, Nick.
70% is a pretty high number. If 70% of the public have been subject to any other kind of attempted crime, you think something would have been done about it. How hard is it to address this kind of thing?
Yeah, it strangely, it's become sort of the cost of doing business online. And I don't necessarily think you'd say that in any other line of business. And you wouldn't be encouraging people to frequent those kind of places. That's the challenge that you face in 2025. It's hard to beat this stuff because it is getting more sophisticated. And what happens here? It's a sheer bombardment, and all you need is somebody to be in a rush, not paying attention, or maybe not being technically minded enough and being scammed. There's sort of, you know, a big mix of factors involved in how people get caught in these things these days. Recently, I was, funny enough, rushing for a meeting with our boss at LBC, and I got a message from the bank saying that there was an issue with my account. The only thing that stopped me from taking it any further is the message started, "Hello, dear," and I don't think my bank manager is going to. But the message looked so realistic, and because I wasn't fully focused and I was thinking about what I was going to say to the boss, I wasn't really paying attention at the same time. But I was expecting bank stuff to be happening. I was expecting some money to be coming in from somewhere. And that's how people get caught quite often. Not fully paying attention, expecting something's happening. And that's why in this data, there's an awful lot of people that are getting caught and scammed with Royal Mail scams. For example, text messages that say there's money to pay on a parcel, or the same with a courier company. Because we all get so many deliveries these days if we're, you know, buying stuff online. That's a common occurrence.
That would have been pretty embarrassing if you'd got scammed.
Oh, I have been. I have been scammed before.
Really?
Yeah, but that's because, I keep reminding myself of this, it's getting harder and harder to spot scams. And that's the reality of where we're at in 2025. Not many people are doing the old hello dear from the bank manager, which happened to me. It's lots of these scammers are now using AI, and there are even toolkits you can buy on the dark web. You can go and buy a, you know, scamming 101 toolkit, which will give you access to loads of email addresses and you know, tools to fake websites, all of those kind of things. So this is almost being kind of monetized, being a criminal, sort of soft, it's almost like a software as a service now, in the same way as, you know, some people sign up for Spotify, there are people on the dark web signing up for services that can enable them to scam people. And all you need is a handful of people either to be not sensible enough to understand if it's a scam, or just harassed and press the wrong button, and you can actually start making money out of this sort of stuff.
How is AI being used then?
Well, AI is being used to create better quality emails, make the email sound more realistic. You could even suggest, you know, send a couple of genuine emails, or use a couple of genuine emails in a chatbot and say, make my email sound like this, so it will write them for you. So when you're having problems, and lots of the issues over the years till now, you've spotted somebody trying to do something in English as a second language. With artificial intelligence coming through, that's getting harder to spot the difference. I think in terms of not having to have graphic design skills now, you can use AI to fake things. This is also coming a lot easier too. And we're in this sort of weird moment in the world of AI at the moment, where it's being used a lot to scam people, but the tools to spot whether AI is being used to scam you are not as widely available yet.
Yeah, are we in a sort of arms race? Because sometimes I'll get a call and my phone screen will turn red and it will say alert, possible scam. So is the ability to detect a scam actually falling behind people's ability to prosecute a scam?
Yeah, and the service you've got there is through your through your mobile company or on the device you're using, depending on a number of different factors. But that is also a whack-a-mole, in that you know, it's really easy now for a call center to purchase like 1,000 numbers at an absolute fraction of a cost, and they can be in Swindon 1 minute, Solihull the next minute, in Switzerland the next minute. So you can kind of switch between places really easily, and it just becomes harder and harder for this stuff to be detected. And you know, in the old days you used to have the telephone preference service in the UK, which would stop junk calls coming to your number. But now all you need is somebody to bounce a call off of an international service, and it's almost impossible for those to be easily sensed and detected. So we are in a whack-a-mole. We are in a continued battle between, you know, at the basis terms, the good guys and the bad guys. And I think that's only going to continue, because there is money to be made in this. You know, if the old 419 scam, you know, the Prince email that we all know, the sort of, when we always used to get the please deposit, I want to deposit the funds, etc., etc., from some prince in Nigeria. If they hadn't worked, they wouldn't still be being done. And that's the thing here, is that all it takes is you can send out hundreds of thousands of these emails. Even if you catch a handful of people, it can be profitable for these scammers.
Yeah, and something else that appears to be happening that is really, really worrying is not so much the, you know, the emails that you used to be able to tell they were fake because there's spelling mistakes all over it, and like you said, they called you dear. But people are using AI to impersonate someone that you know.
Yeah, and there was an insane story earlier this year that didn't get a great deal of coverage in the UK because it sounded almost space age. But there was a, it was a Friday afternoon, and a finance director at a Ferrari was urgently messaging a member of staff and asking them to transfer some money. Really urgent, this needs to be done by the weekend. And we're not talking 50 quid, we're talking hundreds of millions of euros, I think it was. And bizarrely, I don't know what caused the staff member to do this, but they had been in a lift with that boss earlier in the week and asked that boss a specific question about a book whilst they were in conversation. The response they started getting back from this, this was a deep fake that was being used to contact this person. It didn't make sense, and then he asked the question again, and then that person hung up. So that was somebody trying to use the cloned voice of a finance director at Ferrari to try and get a load of money out of the company's accounts. And it was only because a member of staff had the presence of mind to ask that person a question, almost because they were a bit suspicious about what they heard. And then obviously the scammer at the other end couldn't answer the question. And that's how, that's the only reason that scam, which would have been huge financial scam, got stopped.
That does sound like something out of Mission Impossible. How do you clone someone's voice?
Oh, it's quite easy. By the time you get to the news, I could send you a fully cloned Nick Abbott by using audio of your voice. If I took some recordings from Global Player and from the LBC app right now, from the last couple of months, I could make a cloned version of Nick Abbott in about 15 minutes. It would be at about 60 to 70% accuracy, and you would be able to tell the difference, but some people wouldn't.
God. Well, now I'm really frightened.
Get it to do a show next week.
According to this survey, younger people are said to be more vulnerable. That's surprising. I'd have thought that younger people would have been more savvy than older.
Maybe there's some of that is the lack of common sense. Maybe is that being more digitally active, you know, having more accounts and services, kind of being more digitally exposed, if that's a phrase, and being more online would probably be reasons why that would happen. But going back to kind of like the deep fakes and the voice clones and all of those kind of things, it's becoming so common now. And 6 months ago, I'd be going, yeah, it's not really quite ready yet. But on my voicemail at the moment, I've got Burt Reynolds doing my voicemail because the Burt Reynolds estate have handed over his voice to an AI cloning company. And it sounds like Burt Reynolds in any film. And if you can do that with a celebrity, you can do that with anybody else in your life. As long as you've got, a couple of examples of them talking, it's going to be easy to clone anybody. And with that comes cloning friends, cloning family, pretending to be a bank manager. All of those things we'll start hearing more of in the next few months, I would imagine.
And you can also take somebody's phone number, because, you know, if you get a phone call or a text message from somebody that you know that is in your phone, it will come up with their name. But can they not also pretend to be that person and take over their number?
Yeah, there are tools that can make you clone people's numbers, pretend you're people's numbers, trick people's phones into thinking they're getting calls from those numbers. And that's the thing. It's like, going back to where we started, it is the cost of doing business. It is the cost of being online, because there are now so many things being thrown at you as a person, and a person with tons of, things demanding your attention. It is a matter of time before something like this happens to you. Even if you are super sensitive, you know, don't share your passwords with anybody, you're really careful. It's just a balance of probability that in 2025 somebody will try and get into your, you know, get your personal data, get your information, and try to scam you.
And apparently a lot of people just lose a small amount of money. Should they be relieved about that, or could it be the start of something worse?
Well, sometimes the very small amount of money is purely testing whether or not you've got money in your accounts and whether you spot it. So one of the most common ones, actually, is if when they get access to your account, you'll find that it's like 10 quid to a taxi or something very, very small to start with that looks like something innocuous. And then all of a sudden they'll ramp up into, bigger and larger payments. But Nick, it's a matter of time before banks, because, you know, at the moment, everybody sort of thinks, oh, I'll get the money back from the bank if I get scammed. But soon, if the bank call you and they say, have you shared your details with anybody? And you can't categorically prove cast iron that you haven't shared your details, or maybe you haven't updated the software on your phone, you guarantee soon the bank is going to get, you have been responsible with your personal information, or you have your side of the deal. And that's what's going to be the challenge here, is that banks will want to stop paying out for the rampant fraud because it's becoming their biggest expense.
Well, now you've mentioned that, I did get a charge from a cab company that I didn't recognise, a very, very famous cab company that I thought, I didn't take that trip, what's that for?
Yeah, keep an eye on that. If that, I'm not Dean Dunham, but I would keep an eye on that if that's something that's recent, because it could be potentially, if you're not a customer of them already, that could be somebody using it to check if your account is still working.
Right. Do you think that individuals underreport fraud because they either didn't notice or they're just too embarrassed?
I think both of those are very common factors. There are people that don't notice when money is taken from their bank accounts, particularly if it's smaller amounts, it doesn't get noticed. And then there will be people who will feel terribly embarrassed if it happens. You know, it was like, I've heard of cases where, grandparents have been caught in these situations and they're terrified to tell members of their family because they don't want them thinking, they've gone dotty or they're sort of old and unable to look after themselves. Because the reality is a scam can hit anybody at any age. And yeah, I've been, I'm here on LBC routinely talking about how not to get scammed, and I have been scammed.
Do you think that companies, especially financial companies, banks, for instance, whose reputation depends on them being secure, do you think they underreport fraud?
Yeah, definitely. The number of times companies get personal data stolen or they've had data breaches, etc. And there have been examples in the last year or so when major pieces of software or pieces of technical infrastructure have been compromised, as in hackers have managed to get into these boxes and these services, and we know pretty confidently what companies are still using them, and you'd be staggered at the lack of companies who then report the problem that's come with that particular software or piece of hardware. So I think companies are nervous in doing it. It's becoming harder for companies to hide stuff, because when it gets found, the fines are going to start creeping up, and they will be charged more. But we are in a situation where in the old days on LBC, I'd be telling you to have multiple different passwords, change them all the time, etc., etc., etc. But the reality is, if a company can't keep your personal data safe, it's not your fault. Like, if a bank or somebody loses your personal data or hands it over to a hacker or gets it compromised, that's nothing to do with your data security and trying to keep it safe. It's on all of these companies to look after your information too.
So, given that, what practical measures can we take to avoid falling for this fraud?
Well, okay, as I said, I think quite strongly that, unfortunately, it is some of the cost of doing business in 2025. Keep your software on your device updated. Make sure on your computer or on your phone, next time it says do an update, don't roll your eyes and think, oh God, that's going to take me hours. I'll do it when I've got 5 minutes. The reason these software updates come through is because they're often designed to protect you from whatever the latest hack or issue is. Be careful with who you hand over your personal data to. I was buying a pair of trainers the other day and they asked me for my birthday. That company had no interest in knowing what my birthday was unless it was going to give me a free pair of trainers, on my 50th birthday or something, which I don't think it was going to do. And also, if you're really concerned about this, do something like we've done for my dad, who's a bit older and is kind of new in the world of the internet but wanted to get online. Have one bank card or bank account linked to the internet and keep everything else off of the internet to avoid your exposure and your chances of being scammed in other places.
Very good to talk to you, Will. Thanks very much for that. Will Guyot, LBC's technology correspondent. Right, a quick break and then off to America.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
Government ministers are to legislate next month to abolish most short-term prison sentences. This morning, could this be a disaster when it comes to deterring people from committing crime?
Richard Spur on LBC.
Mr. Thing is enjoying a lovely summer's day. He's trimmed the hedge, he's cut the grass, and best of all, he's just had 25% snipped off his home care cover, meaning his boiler, electrics, plumbing and drains are now covered for less. Chop chop, sign up today. This offer ends soon. Search British Gas Home Care Cover. Watch out for that rake, Mr. Thing. Ouch! Too late. British Gas. Taking care of things. T's and C's apply. Offer not available to existing home care or boiler service contract customers. Ends 9th of September 2025.
There's plenty of summer still left to enjoy and lots of wines to enjoy it with. At Waitrose, we've got 25% off six or more bottles of wine or fizz over £6, like the citrusy Esprit de Chablis, perfect with chicken on the barbecue, or a Minuti M Special Edition Rosé, bursting with strawberries, grapefruit and delicate peach, and a fruity San Leo Prosecco, best paired with a sunny spot in the garden. Fill the last days of summer and your wine rack with 25% off at Waitrose. Selected stores and lines, subject to availability, exclude Scotland boxed wines and bottles priced at £100 and over.
All those glasses are a great choice. And now you can pick a free pair from our Boots range.
Free?
That's right.
What, free?
Absolutely. There's hundreds to choose from too.
For free? Does the manager know?
I am the manager.
Oh, in that case, how do these look?
With buy one, get one free at Boots Opticians, everyone can save in style. Book an eye test today and see what's possible. Free Boots pair when you spend £150 on prescription glasses or sunglasses. Offer ends 23rd of September 2025. T's and C's apply.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Having some difficulty getting through to America, but in the meantime, let's talk to somebody much closer to home in Battersea. Hello, Patrick. Patrick. Can't talk to him either. Great. I'll tell you what we were going to talk about with the chap from America in the expectation that at some point in the future we might be able to talk to him. Pentagon officials have confirmed that, as House Minority Leader Jeffries has said, that the president is playing with American lives. Apparently, planning is underway to send National Guard troops to Chicago. That's according to an official at the Pentagon and has been confirmed by ABC News on Sunday. Now, this, of course, is in addition to the troops that he sent onto the streets in Washington, D.C., Trump saying that there was, you know, it was a lawless hellhole, and the people of Washington were crying out for him to send in the National Guard. Now, no such thing happened. There was no problem in Washington. The crime was actually down, but he went ahead and did it anyway. And now the apparently this same thing is happening in Chicago, or is about to. They said, we won't speculate on further operations. The department is a planning organization and is continuously working with other agency partners on plans to protect federal assets and personnel. So it's kind of manufacturing a problem in order to make it seem as though he's providing the solution. Looks like Andrew Feinberg is on the phone now. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Andrew.
Good morning.
Good morning. You are White House correspondent for The Independent. Thanks for being here. We were talking, first, let's talk about this move to send the National Guard troops into Chicago. What's that about?
Well, you have several outlets reporting that there has been a plan in the works to do that. That's something that Donald Trump has, I guess I'll use the word fantasized about doing, going back to his first term. He's long wanted to use the military to put down what he calls out of control crime in heavily Democratic cities, and in particular, heavily Democratic cities with black mayors. Chicago has a black mayor, as does Washington, D.C., as is New York for the moment. And it's New York and Chicago are the cities he's saying he wants to expand his use of the military against crime in. There's just one problem. It's not legal.
It doesn't really matter, though, if it is or isn't legal. Donald Trump has no regard for the law. Whether it's illegal or not doesn't seem to make any difference to him.
No, but it may well make a difference to the people who are getting those orders, because there is a section of the United States Code that punishes using the military in civilian law enforcement with multi-year prison terms. Now, Donald Trump, thanks to the Supreme Court's decision last year on presumptive immunity, could not face criminal charges for using active duty troops for civilian law enforcement purposes, but the active duty troops who carry out his orders could face charges. The civilian officials who transmit those orders could face charges, and the military officers who order the people below them to do these things could face charges. And that's a long list, and it's also something that the courts would step in to stop, because the law is clear. Since 1868, I believe, it has been illegal to use active duty military for civilian law enforcement. And while Donald Trump does have the authority to do that in D.C. because it's the National Guard operating under local authority, because local authority in Washington rests with the president, not with the mayor, because D.C. is not a state. He doesn't have that authority in Illinois. He doesn't have it in New York.
But couldn't Trump, even if everybody that he sent onto the streets was put in jail for taking his orders, couldn't he just then blanket pardon all of them?
That's true. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that those orders are going to be carried out to the extent that he would like them carried out, because there is still in the American military a culture of obeying the law, not just obeying orders.
Has he not purged the military leadership, though, of anybody that might question his authority?
You can't purge everyone. You can't purge the entire officer corps. You can replace generals here and there, but there are traditions and standards, and there is a culture in the American defense establishment that goes back decades and centuries of being a lawful military force. And soldiers are taught from their first day that they are not obligated to follow illegal orders. And you can be sure that there would be pushback if this were to be ordered.
Has it ever happened, though, that a president has given an order that contradicts some military rule, and the military has pushed back?
It's not a military rule. It's black letter law since 1868.
Right.
It's called the Posse Comitatus Act. It was enacted, 1878. It was enacted after Reconstruction to prevent the military from being used to carry out civilian law enforcement. This was after a 10-year period during which the Army had taken over government in the southern states that had rebelled to protect slavery. And as part of a compromise a crisis over a disputed election, Reconstruction ended and this law was passed. So it's been drilled into every American soldier for over a century that this is not what the military's job is. And there would be so much pushback that it would create problems. That doesn't mean that he's not going to try. It's something he has wanted to do. It's something he may attempt to do, but it's not something that will be as easy as it's been for him in Washington, D.C.
Good to talk to you, Andrew. Thanks very much for that. That's it from me. Thanks very much for all your calls and messages. If you miss any of today's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on both Global Player and the new LBC app, on which you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a boatload of podcasts. You can get it for free from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, coming up on 4 on LBC. It's Ian Payne. But first, Richard Spur.
Good morning. Still to come, the Olympic gold medalist Usain Bolt has said that the relocation of the Notting Hill Carnival would kill one of the UK's most important cultural events. I'll be asking if you feel the carnival now does more harm than good, and whether holding it somewhere else might reduce the level of crime it generates. But first, ministers will create laws next month to do away with the majority of short-term prison sentences and bring in an American-type way of doing things where prisoners can get early release in order to avoid any more jail overcrowding. So this morning, do you think that the abolition of smaller sentences will simply encourage potential criminals to break the law? Is early release yet another soft-touch measure which diminishes the fear of those who would breach the rules of society? Or is Labour, on this issue,
finally got it right.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, an investigation is underway in Hertfordshire after a man was hit with a petrol bomb while reportedly putting up flags in Stevenage. Police say he's in his 30s and suffered a head injury after a glass bottle containing a lit rag was thrown on Saturday lunchtime. A group calling itself Stevenage Patriots has said online it was hanging St George's flags for around 3 hours when the attack happened. LBC has been told the nightlife sector has serious concerns about new government plans to ban criminals from pubs. The Justice Secretary has announced the measures, which could also stop them from going to concerts or sports grounds. The government's trying to give judges more sentencing options and reduce overcrowding in prisons. But Michael Kill at the Nighttime Industries Association hasn't been told how it will be enforced.
Well, at the moment, I mean, we have got no dialogue or no clarity or detail from the Ministry of Justice or any other government departments, so we can only act on the headline. The challenge we have is logistically when you start to look at extrapolating this up over a national scale, that's a broader consideration that needs investment, needs infrastructure, and cannot just solely sit as an additional burden for the sector as a whole. That would be a huge concern.
The government says the move will help to stop reoffending and ease pressure on prisons. 140 people have been arrested at and around the Notting Hill Carnival in West London. The Metropolitan Police says 35 were detained on approaches to the event. The figures cover a time period up until 7:45 on Sunday evening. Russia and Ukraine have exchanged 146 prisoners of war from each side. The swap has come about following mediation by the United Arab Emirates. On Sunday, Ukraine marked its Independence Day, but the former Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army, Daniel L. Davis, has been telling LBC things look bad for Kyiv in the absence of any peace deal with Russia.
The power dynamic still is where it has been, and that is in the Russian side. And there is no power, there is no leverage for either the Ukraine or the Europe and the United States combined to force Russia into any kind of concession that is desirable for the Ukraine side. And as long as that continues on, Russia is going to continue to winning the air war, and they're going to continue to winning the fight on the ground as well.
And figures are suggesting more than 500,000 people in England have now received a dementia diagnosis on the NHS. The health service says the number was standing at 490,000 this time last year. LBC weather largely dry with variable cloud overnight. Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland could see some drizzle, and we'll see a low in some places of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Richard Spur.
Good morning. I hope you're well. Nice to be at the start of a new week with you. Well, in the news today, ministers are to legislate next month to abolish most short-term prison sentences, toughen up community punishments, and introduce a Texas-inspired system whereby inmates can earn early release as part of an attempt to avert another prison crisis. Government sources said that the legislation, which will bring about the biggest shake-up in sentencing laws in England and Wales for three decades, would be introduced once MPs had returned to the Commons in September. They said that Shabana Mahmood, the Justice Secretary, was conscious of the need to implement the changes quickly before prisons had another capacity crunch next summer. Well, as far as I'm concerned, they're already having a capacity crunch. I didn't realise that they were in a period of capacity remission. Thousands of inmates were released after Labour won power last summer in an emergency measure to deal with overcrowding. Well, that's a great idea, isn't it? You know, just release them. That's going to solve the problem. The sentencing bill will include measures backed by the government that were recommended by the former Tory Justice Secretary David Goak in a review in the spring. The central change will be the introduction of an incentive scheme or earned progression model. That is the terminology that civil servants have come up for us, an earned progression model, for prisoners serving fixed-term sentences to earn early release with good behaviour. Criminals, including some violent ones, will be able to earn early release after serving between a third and half of their sentence. So the most dangerous criminals and those convicted of terror-related offences will be excluded. That scheme is modelled on a system in place in Texas. That's encouraging, isn't it? Which Mahmoud visited earlier this year and got these ideas from. The bill will also end short sentences of less than 12 months, barring exceptional circumstances, with ministers arguing that these are counterproductive and a driver of more crime. And, I mean, it is one way, of course, to try and tackle prison overcrowding, to send fewer people to jail, particularly those who've committed, in quotes, lesser or minor crimes, sentences which, you know, perhaps are 1 or 2 years. But on the other hand, and we often talk about this when we're discussing issues like shoplifting, for example, you know, if there is no custodial deterrent, if you know that if you're going to commit a certain category of crime, you're very unlikely to go to jail. I mean, what happens to the rule of law in this country? I mean, prison sentences are intended to be a deterrent. It is as simple as that. They are intended to make people fearful of breaching the laws of society. You know, one assumes that prison is not a particularly pleasant place to be in, and the idea that you can maybe go and serve a third of your sentence, and then if you don't do anything bad inside, you can be let out, or indeed won't be sentenced custodially at all, to me raises a big question mark and a worry, I think, in the minds of many law-abiding people who simply want to live in peaceful and lawful communities, that those that break the law will no longer be fearful of the consequences. This morning, I would like to know whether you feel that abolishing short sentences, letting more people out of jail, more criminals out of jail early for quote-unquote good behaviour, is a progressive, creative, essential, necessary modern solution to the overcrowding of British jails? Or should we simply build more jails? I mean, for goodness sake, there's enough space to do that. They don't presumably cost all that much money, although I know it costs, you know, quite a great deal to keep people in custody and keep that deterrent, keep that fear of, if you commit a crime, you know, you will be incarcerated, you will lose your liberty, you will lose most of your rights for a period of time, and, you know, actually rule with a bit of a stick rather than a carrot. 0345 6060973. WhatsApp, same number, text 84850, or ask Alexa to send a comment to LBC. The government also plans to toughen up community punishments. And I remember, I mean, it was, you used to hear a great deal, didn't you, about community service. You were made to go and pick up litter and wear a special high-vis jacket, you know, which said community servant or something like that on it, and do things, you know, remove graffiti, that sort of thing, in order to atone for your crime. Now, I don't know whether that goes on or not. I certainly don't see people doing it. But the government also plans to toughen up community punishments by giving courts more flexibility, more license to impose fines, seize people's stuff, their assets, and introduce bans on travel, driving, and attending football matches. Now, I suppose that sounds a little bit glib, doesn't it? But, you know, actually, for some people, banning them from going to football matches might be more of a deterrent than sending them to jail. I'm being a little bit flippant, but, you know, these days, I think, we are very attached to things like our